Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
What a time it is to be an MMA fan, and thanks so much for joining us. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. And as always, to my left or your right, Matt Allen. You can find him, as always, on the respective socials, at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, while we were away from the UFC predictions, last week we dropped 11 total videos. We got great interviews out there from our own JHK, including four from this card alone. You got some really good things to look forward to. We had the opportunity to kind of step back, talk about some Bellator, some Brave CF. We even got the chance to talk about ONE Championship, big card coming up this week. But Matt, the focus of the previews and predictions this week, we have an awesome card coming up this weekend. 15 fights total, headlined by Darren Till and Marvin Vettori. But scratch that, you have a late notice replacement and a guy that just fought a couple of weeks ago. Our 2020 Fight Night Picks Fighter of the Year, Kevin Holland, stepping in on short notice for Darren Till, taking on Italy's Marvin Vettori. This fight has the opportunity to produce fireworks. I'm really looking forward to it. What are you thinking here?
It should be a really great main event. For Kevin Holland, he basically shot a three-pointer, had an air ball, and the other team just gave him the ball back at the three-point line wide open. Because, let's be honest, I think we were both pretty disappointed with his performance, I guess, 2 weeks ago now.
It's an understatement.
Exactly. Against Derek Brunson, he just didn't look that good. And I personally didn't think the UFC was going to reward Kevin Holland with another main event spot. But he is always ready, and that's the one thing you have to really appreciate about Kevin Holland. Doesn't matter who you are, what weight, what time, Kevin Holland will be ready to fight. So I'm really excited for the main event.
So make sure you check out some of those interviews out there. There's Kyle Daukaus, Sasha Plotnikov, you got Jack Shore, and the man himself, Joe Selecki, who's headlining the prelims against Jim Miller. But Matt, let's throw it on over to our Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen, as always presented by Manscaped. And with 15 fights, it was tough to narrow down this list. And a couple of guys that are no strangers to the bonuses with the UFC. We have Mike Perry taking on Daniel Rodriguez. And listen, if songs became fights, then Ozzy Osbourne would like this one, because it is an absolute crazy train with Mike Perry, a guy that's won four bonuses in the past, two Fight of the Nights, two performance bonuses. For the man, his opposite, Daniel Rodriguez, a guy representing Syndicate and the BMF Ranch, he's got a performance of the night against Tim Means in his UFC debut. And for Daniel Rodriguez, he was a guy that I wrote off before he even made his UFC debut. I mean, you looked at the level of competition, it was subpar at best. And it seemed like a guy that was kind of more well-known for training with big fighters than being a big fighter. But since he's been with UFC, three wins, his lone loss, his last fight out, in a controversial one against Nicholas Dalby. For Mike Perry, 7-7 in the UFC. But it's always fireworks. It's always exciting. This should be a good fight and a possible fight of the night.
These are two guys who love to throw big bombs and hate covering their chins. So I don't know how this couldn't be a fight of the night contender. You have Mike Perry, who we all kind of like, but we all kind of dislike him. He's a very polarizing figure in the MMA world, but his fights are entertaining. Even go back, look at the Mickey Gall fight. Mickey Gall is not UFC caliber, and that was still a fairly entertaining fight. So if that's your most boring fight you've had in the UFC up until this point, I can almost guarantee that a fight against Daniel Rodriguez will produce fireworks. And with Rodriguez too, he is one of those guys who he's going to throw with big power, but he will leave himself open to be countered. So this has the potential to go down as one of the better fights of the year. I really do believe that.
And while JHK had a great interview with Jack Tank Shore, we're Fight Night Picks, we're not going to let any of that bias creep into the overall pick and prediction. But as far as a possible fight of the night, you have undefeated former Cage Warriors champ Shore taking on Hunter Azure, who's an accredited wrestler in his own right, a guy training at a Fight Ready MMA. And we'll talk about the camp structure and everybody he has to train with over there. But for Hunter Azure, just a blood and guts all action type of guy that's always moving forward, always looking to take you down and really mount his offense. And a guy that doesn't normally go away from his wrestling. And if he does, kind of like he did in the Brian Kelleher fight, it doesn't really go his way. Now, that is the lone blemish on his record, for sure. Totally undefeated, and a lot of people have been high on Jack Shore for a very, very long time. He is very slippery on the ground. This is a great one.
Spoiler alert, Jack Shore, very good at grappling, and he is great at rear naked chokes. He really is a specialist with that one position, and yes, he can finish you by a lot of other submissions, but just look up his record. The majority of his wins have come by the rear naked choke. When you're that good at one singular position, it's really interesting. When you do fight a wrestler who is going to sort of take away the wrestling from your game, how is Jack Shore going to take Hunter Azure down? How will it look like if Azure is able to take Shore down? I think there's a lot of interesting questions going into this fight, and I'm excited because I do think Jack Shore is one of those prospects that you can get really excited about as he moves his way up the ranks. And Hunter Azure, he's not the biggest test in the world as, oh, you're fighting a guy in the top five already, but he's a guy who is going to test you in every area of MMA. And for a prospect on his way up, I think this is perfect matchmaking.
Love the fight. It should be a good one. As always, the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen presented by Manscaped. Head on over to the website, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP and save 20% off and get free shipping. And as I always do, I'll talk about my balls later on in the show. But Matt, these are two great Fight of the Night picks. Let us know in the comments below who and why you're picking for the possible Fight of the Night on this card. It is an awesome card coming up this weekend. I'm really looking forward to it. We've got a lot of great things going on with Fight Night Picks. As I already mentioned, 4 interviews from this card alone. We've got some awesome One Championship stuff going on. I mean, there's interviews with Colby Northcutt, Ung Lun Song, Martin Nguyen. Like, there's some great stuff out there. So make sure you check it out while you're hanging around with the channel. You can also find great stuff over on the website as well, fightnightpicks.com. But also at fightnightpicks.com, you can check out the shop. There's all sorts of great Fight Night Picks merch. Matt has the baseball jersey. The season just started. Ooh. You want to look dugout proud. It's with Fight Night Picks gear like that. We get the MLG jerseys. There's also the Under Armour Fight Night Picks hats, as well as the Under Armour shirt that I have on as well. So fightnightpicks.com. Check out the shop. Matt, I love this card. There's so much to talk about. I can't wait to get to it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Really interesting matchup at welterweight. And yes, you heard me say that right, at welterweight, we have Impa Kasanganai taking on Sasha Palatnikov. And Matt, for Sasha Palatnikov, he was all up in the DMs, he was all up in the comments section. After his fight to Luis Cosse, I thought in my head, well, I didn't pick Sasha Palatnikov to win. All right, cool, whatever. And then he does the post-fight interview, and he came after prediction channels that didn't pick him. But it's all water under the bridge now, and we've had the interview with Sasha Palatnikov on the channel for some time. A guy that's training out of Syndicate in Vegas, and he's a guy that spent time training all over the world. I mean, he's a former rugby player. When he was 19, he went to Concordia in Montreal to play football. Both of these guys with football backgrounds, I might add. And for Impa Kasanganai, he went to Lenoir Rhyne to play football. It's pretty cool stuff that you probably didn't know before. But as far as camps are concerned, I remember a big talking point for Palatnikov going into his fight against Luis Cosse in his UFC debut was that he trained with a guy in Sean Strickland. And not only does Sasha Palatnikov look a little bit physically like Sean Strickland, but if you could pick up on certain things that Strickland does well, you could really overcome a guy like Luis Cosse. And if you've ever watched Sasha Palatnikov fight, very much a kickboxing style. There's some very good elements on the ground. If he's on his back, he stays kind of busy. His takedown defense can be a little bit porous at times. We even saw Cosse try to shoot at the end of it. He was just so tired that he couldn't, and Palatnikov was able to take over. But if Sasha Palatnikov really learned anything from his time spent in Canada, maybe he's a Toronto Blue Jays fan, because height doesn't measure heart, as Marcus Stroman used to say, and now he says for the New York Mets.
So
Sasha Palatnikov's last performance was absolutely insane. It was the biggest War Tyone fight that I've ever seen in my life. I thought Cosse had him dead to rights. The commentary team thought that he did too. And Palatnikov rallied. And by the later stages of the first round, Palatnikov started to pull away. Then in the second, then in the third, he earned a performance bonus. And it wasn't just performance. He earned Fight of the Night honors at UFC 255 for that. That was a great card on a pay-per-view. For Impa Kasanganai's last time out, well, he made a track by Kanye West, and can you do it, Matt?
Nah.
Yeah, and listen, it wasn't for good. His last time out about 6 months ago, up at 185, took on Joaquin Buckley. And for Buckley, the hype train's all but really kind of set off. I mean, Alessio Di Chirico took it. Now Di Chirico is going to look to take that same hype away from Roman Dolidze, whatever's left. But for Impa Kasanganai, he's had to really rebuild his career, and he was a guy at 85, heavily muscled. I went down through his career. You talk about a guy that fought mainly at middleweight. He's making his overall pro and amateur combined debut at welterweight for this one. He also switched camps from Jim O, which you know from the John Salters, Joe Selecki's on this card, and others, moving from Jim O down to Sanford MMA, the likes of Henry Hoof. You got the Burns brothers and all sorts of great training partners. Ung Lun Song, great
Jason
interview
Jackson.
Here. Jason Jackson, the ass-kicking machine as well. So for Kasanganai, it'll be interesting to see how much he's been able to kind of learn and grasp as far as not just nutrition and the whole overall weight cut, but game planning wise, moving from Jim O, where you have a lot of wrestler grappler types. Now you're going to Sanford, which you still have those types, but you also have the Lawlers, the Jacksons of the world, much more well-rounded fighters. And if we know anything about Impact Sangani, it's a lot of pressure. He has pretty good offensive wrestling. He's not the biggest grappler, and he rarely throws leg kicks.
I don't know what you left for me to say about this fight, but no, here's the problem that I have with Sasha Palatnikov, even after the Luis Cose fight, and you might disagree with me, just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right. I didn't learn that much from Sasha Palatnikov in that one fight, and yes, I did from maybe a chin aspect, maybe from a cardio aspect that I didn't know going into that fight, but you still got cracked and almost finished by a guy in Luis Cose who, yes, he was a big favorite going into that fight, but leaving that fight, I don't really think Luis Cose is going to be setting the world on fire anytime soon. I think if Palatnikov showed anything, he showed a great heart. And that does mean something in MMA. There's a lot of people who, they face resistance, and their first look is they want to look towards the door, and they want to try to find a way out. Sasha Palatnikov is not that guy, and I know that now. But if Luis Cose is able to close that distance, can crack you a lot, it just does concern me when he is going to start to fight those other high-level strikers who can close the distance. Because for Palatnikov, and I think you would say it the right way, he's a great kickboxing striker, but I do think if you close off the range of his kicks, you can force him to become kind of a brawler. And I always go back and think of Mirko Krokop versus Fedor Emelianenko, where no one figured out before that fight that, hey, maybe if you move towards the kicker, you crowd his legs, he won't be able to really get those big kicks off. And for Palatnikov, when people do pressure him, it is really hard for him to plant his feet and throw a kick. He will have to resort a lot more to his hands. And I'm not saying he has bad hands by any chance, but the thing that makes Sasha Palatnikov striking so deadly and so effective is the ability to mix in his kicks with his hands. Now, against Impa Kisanganai, it will be interesting, and I don't know if you've seen any recent pictures of Impa. That man is jacked, and I thought Leon Edwards at 170 was the new biggest fighter at 170 after his time off, but Impa Kisanganai has given him a run for his money, and I do think that size, I guess advantage and disadvantage, depending on how you want to look at it, will play a big factor in this fight. Because let's say Kisanganai has a tough weight cut. He was heavily muscled at 185. You're going down to 170. I wouldn't say a bad cardio at 185, but let's say a tough weight cut. It would knock him down from average cardio, I'd say, to poor cardio. There's just starting to get a lot of different intangibles that will make you worry if you are really tied to Impa Kisanganai. And especially, I know you're going to get to the odds. They are quite skewed toward Kisanganai. I just don't see him being this heavy of a favorite. Because you look up and down his UFC record, I know a lot of people want to bring up, oh, well, Buckley hit him with that big knockout shot. He didn't look good in that Buckley fight even before that knockout. And that's the thing that does concern me for Kisanganai. Everyone likes to bring up the fact that, oh, he got knocked out by that shot. But even just go back and watch the fight leading up until that one knockout blow. He's kind of uncomfortable on the back foot. He doesn't throw enough volume to really keep power punchers off of him. It's not that I don't like what Impa Kisanganai does. I just don't know what he does all that well. It's kind of funny. That's what we were talking about even before we started filming. And last thing, for Impa, the move to Sanford MMA, I do think will be a very beneficial one. Because like you had mentioned, Jim O is an up-and-coming Jim, if you will. They're one of those Joe Rogan's new favorites where he'll shout them out on the broadcast. But Sanford MMA is an established super gym. And when you go down there, you are training with other world champions and other world champion caliber fighters. So I think a move like that for someone like Impa Kisanganai could only do positives for him. And I do think this will be a really interesting fight. And honestly, a really good fight for it being the first fight on the card.
You look at it in this one, and I mean, as far as age differential is concerned, Palatnikov quite a bit older coming into this one, almost 5 years older, but again, younger maybe in his career as far as pro experience is concerned. You talk about the level of competition for Palatnikov, we went back and watched so many Palatnikov fights, and yes, you look to the Munir Lazez loss at UAE Warriors, that's all right, we know exactly what Munir Lazez is and how good he is. And then you look at Palatnikov since the loss, he beat Paulo Henrique. That was on super, super short notice. He was a jiu-jitsu practitioner. And you saw, I mean, Palatnikov could keep his hands down. He could kind of get excited. And the one thing that I love about Sasha Palatnikov, and it doesn't matter about if it's just this fight, if it's any other fight, and we even got to see it in the Kose fight, he throws spinning attacks, but he throws them at smart times. Like, he doesn't just whiff spinning back fists like a Merab Dvoishvili
like
will.
Like Zabit will.
Sasha will really plan it out, think about it, and it's hard to see it coming. So he does a great job of that. He throws a nice spinning back kick to the body. He'll throw a back fist, back elbow. Maybe that could cause Kisanganai some troubles. I'd say he might have shored up some of those defensive holes, but you're right. From Kisanganai, the level of competition, the five on in, you're talking a split decision win over Devorius Tubbs, who was 4-3. Almost 2 years ago. He beat Kalen Hill on Contender Series. He had to fight on Contender Series again. He took a long time off. He beat Sugarfoot Adams. It was a fight. He beat Joaquin Pitolo by decision, then he beat Joaquin Buckley. And I know
he lost to Joaquin Buckley.
He lost to Joaquin Buckley in emphatic fashion. The odds in that one were weird. The odds in this one are weird, too, and you talked about it a little bit, but for Sasha Platnikov, open to plus 205, he's now plus 238. And if you look at Impa Kasanganai, a big favorite, he opened at a minus 240, he's now minus 304. It surprises me. I get it, you know, the highlight reel, the gym change. Let's talk about what Kasanganai does well, because I mentioned it. You know, you talk about the fact that he rarely throws kicks. Out of those four fights, Contender Series and two in the UFC, 11% of his overall strikes are kicks. That's not good. And then if you look at it, they're skewed because the highest percentage of kicks that he's ever thrown, 21% were against Joaquin Buckley. So I wonder, in a fight like that where you're actually actively throwing kicks and it caused him such an issue, maybe those two things aren't related. We see him going out there and kicking some more.
I don't think they are related. And this is my only reason why. Because Kasanganai has good kicks. He just doesn't throw them. And I do think a gym change will make all the difference in that. Because if you go to a new gym, they don't have to fix your kicking technique as much as they just have to fix your game plan. And I do think with a gym like Sanford MMA, they can switch up your overall game in only 4 or 5 months. And I know we'll talk later on about other fighters. I'm normally not a big fan of fighters who do make that initial gym change. Just because I do think it takes a little bit of time for them to settle with that gym, but this is one of the few cases where I think Impa Kasanganai and Sanford MMA really are a match made in heaven.
Well, if we look at the topology votes, Matt, again, heavily skewed in Kasanganai's favor, 1,047 of them, 79% Kasanganai, 74% have him to win by decision. If you look at Sasha Platnikov, 21% have him, 50% by knockout, 44% by decision. Again, I worry about the weight cut for Kasanganai because I've never seen him at 170 pounds before.
The one good news, though, and you did mention it, he is the much younger fighter. If you're 27 going for that weight cut, I'm a lot less concerned than if you're 35, 36, like we saw Dalton Champ do. We've seen a few other fighters, too. If you are in your kind of late 20s, under 30, really, I'm not as concerned about the weight cut. If Kasanganai was 32, and let's say Platnikov was the one who was 27. For that reason, that's maybe why I'm not putting as much stock into the weight cut as you are, but I do think it will be a very massive wrinkle in this fight.
If we see Impa Kasanganai fight like he has before, like in the Maki Pitolo fight, where it's just a lot of pressure and he just kind of smothers you, I think that's a great opportunity for him to pick up a win in a fight like this. For Platnikov, great counters, and maybe that weight cut is such an issue that you really like Platnikov in this fight. I wouldn't fault you in the slightest for that. I'm going with Impa Kasanganai in this fight again. I think the wrestling can win out in a circumstance like this if he really gets himself in any type of danger. However, those odds scare me off this fight for good. It's a pop and popcorn fight for me.
I agree 100%. For Impa, I do think the path to victory is going to be his wrestling. And for Platnikov, he's okay off of his back. You would kind of mention it. He's not great. He's not like a Brian Ortega. The problem I do have with Platnikov is he can keep his guard, but he will just close his guard and kind of wait out time sometimes, especially if he is on his back. If Kasanganai could just make this fight boring, and I hate it when I say that, but it is the truth sometimes. If Impa Kasanganai can make this fight somewhat boring, get it to a grinding halt where you don't let Platnikov get off some of those fancier techniques, I think that's by far Impa's best path to victory. But this really could be one of those fights that I switch on question mark kicks. If Kasanganai can barely make it to the scale on Friday and looks awful, then maybe we have a switch of picks, but I do think the weight cut won't be that big of an issue.
Have to check in on Saturday's episode of question mark kicks, but Matt, we're both going with Impa Kasanganai to get the win. Really looking forward to this weekend's card. Our co-main event, Sadiq Youssef taking on Arnold Allen in the main event. Short notice, Kevin Holland, the man himself, taking on Marvin Vettori. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Really interesting fight at light heavyweight, Matt. We have South Korea's Daun Jung taking on William the Nightmare Knight. And realistically, we're getting ready for multiple William Knight fights. I had to write it down in my notes just so I'd know. We got ready for a fight against Alonzo Menafield in February. Then we got ready for a fight in March. Now we're in April. We got ready for Daun Jung to take on Shamil Gamzatov. Now we're here. And these two guys are going to fight each other. And for Alonzo Menafield, well, he got a totally different fight. He looked amazing against Fabio Chiron. Can William Knight replicate Alonzo Menafield's success when he takes on Daun Jung in a game of musical chairs? I like the fight, and I say this a lot, and a lot of people criticize me for it. Oh, really excited for this one. Yeah, I am, because for Daun Jung, this is a guy that started his career off at 1-2, and he's on an amazing 12-fight win streak. He's got to draw his last time out against Sam Alvey. And if you go back and watch that fight, it was really disappointing.
It was awful.
If you go back, MMA decisions where the media members post their scores, 17 members had it 29-28 for Alvey. Three had it 28-28, and one had it 29-28 for Daun Jung. It was a really weird fight where Daun Jung was a big favorite in that one, wasn't able to get the win. I mean, if you watch his fights, he's got a really good jab, and it's one thing that I really hammer home, but he's the type of guy that can double it up, triple it up. He can throw the stiff jab, like we make fun, but Trevin Giles throws a really stiff jab. For Daun Jung, he sets things up. I'd love it if he threw in combination a little bit more. Now, when we talk friend of the show, former friend of the show, current member of the show, friend of the show, JHK, because in this case, just friend of the show, did an interview with Daun Jung over with SCMP MMA, and I know the headline right off the hop was he wants to knock out William Knight. It's a tough ask. I mean, Tafon Chukwe was able to do it where he probably wasn't expected to do it. At the time, William Knight had already signed the developmental deal with the UFC. He was like a part-time, occasional guest commentator with CFFC, John Morgan, CM Punk, and the boys. Sometimes fingers get lost in those fights. Yeah. But William Knight was kind of on a rise to success. He gets finished by Tafon Chukwe, and it's not like it was that long ago, a year and 3 months ago. He beats Rocky Edwards. He beats Cody Brundage on Contender Series. The thing that I love, and I remember going back, previewing the fight, we had William Knight stepping in on just weeks' notice to take on Alexa Kammer. Not an easy fight. Not I mean, Kammer, really hype prospect, really good boxing in his own right. William Knight implemented his own game plan on short notice, made the weight, which, you know, people were worried about, and looked good in that fight. Like, I thought he really proved out. And what do we know about William Knight? To look at him, you think, geez, the guy's a brick shithouse, and he probably packs a punch. And he does. But he's got sneaky wrestling and a good clinch game.
And he's a really cerebral fighter, too. You had mentioned that he does do some commentary work. Most fighters who do that commentary work have great cage IQ. And I do think William Knight is one of those cases. Just, he doesn't have the overall body of work that's really been able to prove that over time. And I do think as he fights in the UFC and you become a little bit more familiar with him, it will start to show. And against Daun Jung, this should be a very fun fight. If you go back and kind of take out the Sam Alvey fight, look at what he was able to do to Mike Rodriguez. Look at how good he looked against Hadis Ibrahimov. He's had good wins in the UFC so far, but that Sam Alvey fight was really disappointing because Daun Jung, I don't know if he just didn't have a treadmill at his gym. I don't know what happened. It didn't look like the fighter that we had known in those previous two fights. It's a little concerning because you look at Daun Jung, his last, I would say, impressive fight was the Slow Mike fight, and that was a year and a half ago. Then you look at his last fight 5 months ago. He didn't look that great, so now I'm a little bit concerned. Which version of Daun Jung are we going to get? And I understand he had Alvey hurt. He tried to finish him early. But if you're getting tired against a fighter like William Knight, who we know for that great power punching, I just don't think it's going to work out for you. You can get away with the poor cardio and maybe some defensive lapses against a guy like Sam Alvey. And we can say Sam Alvey, his best days are behind him. He's not the best fighter in the world. Having a close fight against Sam Alvey and then jumping into a fight against William Knight, it's just going to be a really tough one. Alvey was able to land clean a lot in that fight. It's not like he was always hitting arms. It wasn't always like Daun Jung was being smart at covering up. Alvey was able to land clean shots over and over again. And with William Knight, I was really concerned in that camera fight. It's on short notice. We don't really know how good his cardio is. He showed off a pretty good cast tank and a very impressive one, I guess, just by based on where I thought it was going to be. I thought, oh, if Kammer's going to win, he's going to out-volume him. He's going to really put it on him with the output and probably tire Knight out. But Knight, like you had mentioned, really good cardio, really smart game planning. And I do think William Knight's a case of a fighter who can make adjustments during the fight. I don't think if you see a fight where he's going out there and just popping out the right hand, trying to knock him out with one punch, he's not going to keep on doing that same plan in round two and round three. He will switch it up. I know we talked about that a little bit with Stipe fighting Francis. Didn't turn out well for him, but fighters who are able to make that round-to-round adjustment, I always think that's a very high-level X factor that we don't often see in fighters who are unranked, and the fact that both these guys are unranked and we still are going to get a very high-level fight between them, I'm really excited for it.
The weird thing about this one, for Daun Jung, I talked about it, I mean, I like his boxing, he's not the biggest kicker, could we see some more kicks out of William Knight? I definitely think we will, but for Daun Jung, very good takedown defense, and that's one of those things I think it could play a factor in this, and if you go back and look at that first run as he turned pro, he went 1-2. One of his losses is to Roque Martinez. That's a UFC heavyweight. How crazy is that?
That's wild.
For William Knight, a guy that trains out of Thornton Martial Arts. Have you heard of him? I don't know if you have, but if you go to his Instagram, one of the weirdest things, because you're not going to find any training tape at all, it's just strength and conditioning drills. And it's crazy to see a guy doing a lot of lifts and cardio. So in a fight like this, for Daun Jung, much more technical puncher. That usually lends credence to a pick. Very, very good takedown defense as well. So, Matt, if we have a look at the odds for this one, Daun Jung is the favorite, albeit slightly. He opened at, just again, a minus 130. He's now minus 138. The line's popped up a little bit. For William Knight, open minus 110. He's now at a plus 114. And if we look over on Tapology, Matt, 55% of voters that have Jung, 62% by knockout. The other 45% that have William Knight, 65% by knockout. The fans are predicting a finish. The gamblers are going with Dan Jung. The fans are going with Dan Jung. Matt, who are you going with?
If I could just predict that this fight will end before the end of the 15 minutes, that's what I would do. Because I do agree. I think this fight has finished all over it. I think Dan Jung has more than enough power that if he can catch William Knight overextending himself, he will be able to hurt him. I just think William Knight, he has the pressure. He has the wrestling defense and offense. And that's the really important thing. For Jung, like you had mentioned, he has the wrestling defense. He's not going to be going for a lot of takedowns in this fight. And even if he does, I do think William Knight, just the physicality of him, will be able to defend a few of those takedowns from Jung. Not saying that's the best idea for your cardiovascular over three rounds, but still, I just think the sheer strength of William Knight might be able to defend a few of those takedowns. And on the feet, I do think the power of Knight will eventually get to Jung. I do think Jung starts to go, he doesn't fall off a cliff after the second round, but he does have just a natural cardio where he will get tired as the fight progresses. And if William Knight can really bring pressure to Jung, he's going to force him to fight a lot. And if you do force Dian Jung to become more of a volume fighter, he will start to fade as the fight progresses.
Disagree.
And then I favor William Knight. That's fine.
Hard disagree, because if you go back in that Sam Alvey fight, he definitely won the third round. He didn't win the first. He didn't win the second. He had a knockdown in the third, and his output actually went up. And he had a lot of control time in that fight. So, for me, it is a tough one. I mean, again, if Dan Jung has very good takedown defense and he can start to land a lot of volume, pressure William Knight. Knight's the type of guy that keeps his hands a little low and his head up quite high. And when he moves in, he's able to shoot quite well. But it's a tricky one. I do like William Knight in this fight, but I agree with you. If you could take like the under 2.5, maybe that's a pretty good one to go with. But I am going with William Knight. Again, I just think the volume, I think the pressure, it's just going to cause issues for Dan Jung. Could I see Jung winning this? 100%. He's a favorite. The fans have him to win. But I'm going to go with the underdog in this one, in William Knight. I'm really eager to see what people are thinking about this one down below in the comment section. It's a great fight. This is one that was on the short list for possible fight of the night. But we're both going with William Knight to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. You have 15 fights total. Co-main event, Arnold Allen taking on the man himself, Super Sadiq Youssef. And in the main event, got Kevin Holland being a good guy, stepping on short notice to take on Marvin Vittorius. Really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time action at featherweight, Matt. We have the UFC debut of Luis Saldana, who's going to be taking on Jordan Griffin. And it's an interesting one for Luis Saldana, a guy coming in here at 30. He started his pro career 10 years ago, grinded away in the minor leagues. He's got an overall record of 14-6. He's like the Yermin Mercedes of MMA. And listen, the hit streak couldn't continue for Mercedes, but it could for Saldana in this fight. He's got a really interesting one ahead of him. And if you look at his overall body of work, all of those 14 wins are by finish. That's absolutely insane. 6 by knockout, 8 by submission. A guy coming at us from Fight Ready MMA in Arizona. And we've talked about Fight Ready before, and we're going to talk about Fight Ready even more with Santino DeFranco. And he's training with Kamuela Kirk, and I think that's really going to help him in a fight like this. Take on a guy in Jordan Griffin, out of Rufus Sport, that's kind of been there and done that. And if you look at his overall body of work, he's had 4 more pro fights. He's a year older in his career. But you look at Jordan Griffin's overall body of work before he came into the UFC, and it's a lot of recognizable names. I mean, he's got a loss to Dan Moret, a loss to Bellator champ Juan Archuleta. And then when he came up, I mean, a win over Derek Minner by sub. That win just keeps looking
that's
better.
Impressive.
And in the UFC, he makes his debut against Dan Ige, loses, fights Chaz Skelly, loses, beats TJ Brown in a super emotional win, and then he loses to Yusuf Zalal in kind of a, you know, it was what it was.
Yeah.
But he lost that fight, his second of 2020. He was originally supposed to rematch with Derek Minner. Minner missed weight, so he had to wait a week or two to get the fight against Yusuf Zalal. But you have a fight here where Jordan Griffin always fights pretty well the same. He strikes the clinch, he clinched to get the takedown, and then he wants to get the submission. For Luis Saldana, he can definitely get the submission. Again, 8 of his overall 14 wins by submission. His overall level of competition, not as high as that of a Jordan Griffin. I mean, we're talking losses to Mike Santiago. Yes, that guy that fought in the UFC that time back in 2016. But if you look at the recent win streak for Luis Saldana, 4 in a row, he had that Carl Wittstock win that looks great from LFA 60. took some time off, and then fought Vince Murdoch on Contender Series. And it was a weird one, because Murdoch was a guy, he already had a contract, he was supposed to fight in the UFC. Do you know he's supposed to fight in the UFC?
Who?
Jordan Griffin. He was supposed to fight Jordan Griffin in Milwaukee. It didn't happen. Murdoch had that weird health scare, and then these guys fought. And Luis Saldana bodied him up and pieced him up and finished him with an insane front kick and then just pounded away while he basically was sitting on his face. I wish I never said that on this channel, but I did. And then he just hammered away in his face. Luis Saldana, triple threat. Love the fight. This is a good one.
I don't really know where to go from there, to be honest. Jordan Griffin never fights the way I think he's going to fight, even though I know how he's going to fight every time he fights. I understand that doesn't make any sense, but I look at Craig's face, and he understands what I'm trying to get across. Jordan Griffin, when his stance makes him look like he is some Henry Cejudo, Wonderboy Thompson-esque fighter, and he doesn't have terrible stand-up, the point is, he doesn't use it. And that's the weird thing about Jordan Griffin. I actually think if he used his stand-up more, and here's the thing. Normally with grapplers, I'm very against it. I say, just get really good at wrestling, learn how to choke people out, and never strike. But Jordan Griffin, his movement's not bad on the feet. He does have fairly good striking, but everything he does in his game is to get away from the striking, and I will never understand why. Because when he does close the distance, he is fighting a lot of guys who, they have the wrestling base that he doesn't have. Where Jordan Griffin, we know him for his submissions, we know him for his jiu-jitsu. If he did just become more of that, I'm a really good striker, if I drop you, I'll go for the submission. But Jordan Griffin just gets tired going for takedowns, and I don't get it. It's a really frustrating thing, because... Now, I can also say this. Every time I think Jordan Griffin's going to win, he doesn't. Every time I think he's going to lose, it turns out he's going to win. So I might sound a little salty here. But with Griffin, I just don't really know what I'm going to get out of him in this fight. And you mentioned how emotional he was after the Brown win. He went on to say, oh, well, if I lost this one, that was going to be it for my UFC career. And I feel like he is in a very similar position going into this fight. So if you are Jordan Griffin and you're like, okay, when the light shine brightest, I'm going to show up. Like, if I lose this, I'm out of the UFC. This is the fight you have to show up for. And against Luis Saldana, you are going to have that opportunity on the ground. And you bring up how 8 of his 14 wins are by submission. I actually don't think Saldana can submit Griffin. I think he can drop him, and I think he could control him on the ground, but I do think he's going to have a very hard time on the mat with Jordan Griffin. And the best path to victory for Saldana would be to keep it on the feet, even though I've just spent the last minute and a half telling you I wish Jordan Griffin struck more. It's just a really odd fight for both guys, because they are kind of the yin and yang of the other one. Can Jordan Griffin strike? I actually think he's pretty good at it. He just decides not to. He's great on the mat, though. And with Saldana, a lot of his submissions do come from, I'm going to hurt my opponent on the feet. Then once it's on the mat, I've got great scrambles, great submissions. The thing that does worry me with Saldana is that he will just jump for a submission. You had mentioned earlier, position over submission. Saldana isn't always like that. And I always bring up the case about when Gilbert Burns was in Tyron Woodley's full mount and he jumped to a triangle a little bit too early. If you're really good on the ground, like a Gilbert Burns level player, you can get away with some of those mistakes. But if you're Saldana and you do try to jump on an arm, go for any position that might end with Jordan Griffin on top. That's a very risky proposition for this fight.
To me, I mean, I look at it, you got Jordan Griffin out of Rufus Sport. You talk about the level of opponent or the level of training partner there, the Pettis brothers, and so on and so forth. Felder, we've seen great fighters come out of there. Maybe if you mix it up a little bit with, like, VFS Academy. Have Anaxio Bahamondes on this card, as well as Bilal Muhammad. But maybe if you mix it up with some more of the strikers, you never know what you could get out of Jordan Griffin. You're right. I agree with you. And, I mean, if you look at Griffin, out of his overall 18 wins, 9 of them by submission. But for him, he can lock it up at any point. For TJ Brown, he got a little sloppy, a little tired, and Griffin was right there to submit and did a great job in that one. For Luis Saldana, I mean, I had it in my notes. You can work behind the jab. He can throw a lot of really good kicks. If he throws his outside kick, he usually follows it up with a hook. He throws very well in combination. The weird thing with him, though, he's a plodding type of striker, and he can kind of get a little flat-footed. If he takes on somebody that has a really nice low kick, it would be a big issue for Luis Saldana. I don't know if we're going to get that out of Jordan Griffin in this fight. So it'll be interesting to see both guys. You would think for Luis Saldana, he's usually the tallest fighter in the cage when he fights. For Jordan Griffin, he's also usually the tallest fighter when he steps into the cage. If you have a look at it, I mean, both guys, 5'11", 5'10", the reach, incredible for this division. So two of the bigger guys that you're going to see here. It'll be interesting to see if Griffin can kind of bring in his perceived grappling, advantage in a fight like this against a guy like Saldana. Because you have to expect, if you watch Saldana's last fight, and then you go back a little bit further, his striking continues to progress. And if he's a submission over position guy, That really plays into the hand of Jordan Griffin.
It does. Stylistically, this fight just really is interesting because Griffin does a lot of things that can kind of go against him in a certain way. If he goes into the clinch a lot, I can expect him to walk into a big shot from Saldana, and that's going to be the issue. If Griffin was the one who could stay behind his jab, could be dedicated to some of those probing shots on the outside, I would like him a lot more. My issue is, for Jordan Griffin to have success, he's going to have to be reacting to the pressure that Saldana brings to him. So if you're constantly reacting to what your opponent's doing, A, you're going to fatigue faster, and B, you're always going to be that half step behind. So I think, A, whoever's moving forward will probably win this fight. I just think Luis is going to be the one moving forward.
So Matt, if we talk about the odds in this one, Saldana open at minus 135 favorite. He's now minus 143, slight change in favor of Saldana. For Jordan Griffin, open to plus 115. He's now about a plus 117. And if we have a look at Tapology, it's a surprise to me as it is to you. 993 total votes, 74% Saldana, 74% by decision. The experience lies in the corner of Jordan Griffin. There's a lot of people that like to go with experience in a fight like this. For Saldana, again, fight ready, the Cejudo connection. He's a guy that came in on Dana White's Contender Series last summer. It was season 4, week 8. And on that season, we had a lot of UFC fighters. Jared Vander fought Harry Hunsucker, but you never thought Harry'd be a UFC fighter. But he is. You also had Ignacio Bahamondes on that episode, as well as Carlos Ulberg. Now, Matt, out of those fighters, well, 3 out of the 4 I just named have lost in the UFC. So, Ignacio, let's see what you're made of this weekend. It's going to be a very interesting fight. What's the pick here?
I'm going to slightly edge Luis Saldana in this fight. I'm not going to switch my pick. I will stick with it throughout the week. But this is a really hard one to pick because I do think if Griffin could get on top of Saldana and really make him work, he's going to be able to fatigue him quite a bit to where maybe Griffin will be able to get a takedown of his own as the fight goes on. But for me, I do think Saldana, he's the much more heavy-handed striker out of the two. Do I think Saldana could beat TJ Brown? Yes, I do. Do I think he could also lose to Danny Ige and Yusuf Zolo? Yeah, I do. So I do think this is a very well-matched up fight between these two, and I do think it will result in a very fun fight. But yeah, I pick a Saldana in this.
For Jordan Griffin, if you have a look at it, all three of his losses, he lost 29-28. All of them. All the judges every time. He won a round against Danny Ige, against Chaz Skelly. He also won a round in his last fight. I like that. I mean, I love that level of competition for Jordan Griffin. The thing about Saldana, he's been in the game for 10 years. He's got a great gym. Could I see him walking in there and getting like a highlight reel knockout of Jordan Griffin? Sure. But I feel like, again, the quality of training partner that Griffin has at Rufus Sport really going to mitigate some of those issues. The striking defense, not the biggest of concern. The way to beat Jordan Griffin, you got to kind of grind on him and not let him get those submissions. And it's a really tough ask for anybody.
If Chaz Skelly can out-grapple you, though, you're not in that elite of elite grapplers. And that's my problem with Jordan Griffin. I think he's a good grappler, but he's in my mind. I always bring this up. I never say this on the show, but just something I always think about. OSP isn't a black belt level grappler, but when he gets you in a Von Flu, that's his black belt level position, if you will. With Griffin, he's got the guillotine. He has some positions, but sometimes his overall grappling game, he can get swept if he's on top. He will have some lapses defensively on the ground. So for that reason, that's why I can't be 100% on Jordan Griffin, but I really can't disagree with your pick.
Matt, you're going with Luis Saldana to win his UFC debut. I'm going to be going with Rufus Sports. Jordan Griffin to get the win. Really looking forward to this fight. We got 15 total on the card, including a great main event between the Trailblazer and King's MMA's Marvin Vettori. So really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight and a possible fight of the night as we have Wales Jack Shore taking on Hunter Azure. And we've talked about Fight Ready enough times really to do a whole series. And for Hunter Azure representing Fight Ready MMA, I mean, you talk about the quality of training partner there for him. I mean, Luis Saldana that we just talked about, but also Casey Kenney and the like, Santino DeFranco, really doing a good job leading the charge for Jack Shore representing Tillery Combat MMA Academy with, well, his dad, Elder Shore, but he also has great guys like Brett Johns, and we've seen it from Jack Shore, one of the most hyped prospects in MMA right now in the UFC, and it's great to have this influx of Welsh talent. I mean, Corey McKenna doing a great job in some of the lower weight classes, but you also have Shore. We talked about Brett Johns. He's going to be making moves with Bellator shortly, but also Mason Jones as well, so a lot of great Welsh talent coming into the bigger leagues, and for Jack Shore, undefeated in his pro career, but undefeated in the UFC. More importantly, great finishes, and he's been on a tidy little finish streak. He beat Aaron Phillips, he beat Nolene Hernandez, and between those, he was booked to take on Geraldo de Freitas. That one fell through. He was also supposed to fight Anderson Dos Santos, and late last year, and we had done a video on it, he was supposed to fight Khalid Taha. Now, that fight was off. Jack had a hard time getting the visa to go to the States, but not having a hard time this time, taking on Hunter Azur. For Jack Shore, he is a grappler. And he is one of the best grapplers you're going to see. For Hunter Azur, very accredited NAIA credentials as far as wrestling is concerned, but that's the game plan. If Hunter Azur is to strike like he did against Brian Kelleher, well, boy, oh boy, did he blow his load in the first round of that fight, and it went downhill after that. Now, credit where it's due. Brian Kelleher is a game opponent, and it's tough to beat a guy like that. That was Azur's test. He wasn't able to get by it. This is Jack Shore's test because Hunter Azur is as game as they come. You look at him so far in the UFC, his debut was against the Canadian in Canada, and he beat Brad Katona, and he blew him out of the water.
He did.
So for Azur, great wrestling, great top pressure, very hard to sweep when he is on top. He's a guy that's more position over submission, but this should be such a great scramble fest that to me, again, mark this on your calendar somewhere. This is appointment viewing.
So I agree with you. It could be a great scramble fest, but there's just this little voice in the back of my head, and I'm sorry. It's one of those Jack Shore is going to go out there and just dominate Hunter Azur. And it's true because every time I look at two grapplers fighting each other and you have one grappler who is slightly better, look at Carla Esparza versus Tatiana Suarez. Carla Esparza is almost fighting for a UFC title right now. She's in the top five of the women's strawweight. She's a very, very good wrestler, especially in MMA. She's not just a good wrestler, a great MMA wrestler. Tatiana Suarez made it look like she had never been in a wrestling mat in her entire life. Now, I'm not saying Jack Shore is going to go out there and completely ankle pick Hunter Azur and make him look like an amateur when it comes to wrestling. I don't predict that whatsoever. When it comes to grappling, though, Jack Shore is, I don't want to say the best in the division because I haven't seen him fight those upper echelon levels of competition.
Are we going
yet.
Like Travis Luter is Michael Jordan-esque in grappling?
No. I'm not going to say that Jack Shore, like Jonathan Martinez, could get into the top 15 of, and I quote, whatever division he chooses. But I do think that Jack Shore, all the hype is real and it is justified because the way he goes out there and beats his opponents, it's not like he can go out there and beat them with one punch. His striking isn't that great. He does have very rudimentary striking, but the good thing about it is he knows what he's good at. And that's important. There's a lot of MMA fighters, like I mentioned with Jordan Griffin. He's not bad at striking, but in his mind, he must think, oh man, I'm just so good at grappling. Let's just get this fight to the mat. Jack Shore realizes, pretty good at wrestling, great at jiu-jitsu. Not so great at striking. If I get the fight to the mat, that's where my success is going to come from. And he's not one of those fighters who will, oh, I'm going to try to strike a little bit to get my way into the clinch. He fights a lot like Gregor Gillespie, the more I think about it. The difference is, Shore will try to finish you with a submission, whereas Gillespie, it's a lot of, I'm going to ride you a lot, try to tire you out, and then I'll go for the finish. Shore can do that, and if you look at a lot of his finishes, it is after he is able to fatigue his opponent. I liken him almost to Grant Dawson. Now, I don't predict he's going to knock out Hunter Azur with a back fist while standing, but they do share some similarities in their game, and that's why I love the grappling of Jack Shore.
You want the Hunter Azur comp? It's Chad Mendes. For me, if you watch Hunter Azur strike, he can really throw in combination. If you go back and watch the Cole Smith fight, Chad Mendes dropped him though? Early in that fight. But for Azur, again, it's a lot of position. It's a lot of heavy wrestling. And if he goes in there and he wants to strike, it can go well like it did in the Cole Smith fight. It can go poorly like it did in the Brian Kelleher fight. Now, again, in the first round, it went great for Azur. And then in the second round, it didn't. And that was a little bit of the problem in the Cole Smith fight, too. Good in the first round. Pretty good in the second round. In the third round, the cardio started to kind of die down a little bit. And by the end of that fight, I'm not saying Cole Smith, if he had an extra 30 seconds, he would have won, but he had Hunter Azur's back, and Azur was tired. You never know. The Canadian could have got the dub. So I like Hunter Azur a lot. I think he's a very good fighter. I also like Jack Shore a lot. Like, this is really good matchmaking.
Jack Shore is everything I thought JP Bayes would be. It's just, he's way better. That's the thing. And for sure, I do think he is that hyped-up prospect, but he is the justified hyped-up prospect. I don't think we're getting I hate to compare him to Sean O'Malley, but Sean O'Malley was okay. You're a big star. You're going to get a big fight. If you lose it, you're still a star no matter what. It's not like Jack Shore has to do a ton of media. It's not like people are calling Jack Shore all the time. He just cares about getting better every single day, and I care a lot more about that in a prospect than I do someone who is more hyped up. So I think Shore's not only going to go out there and get the win, I'm actually going to predict him to get the stoppage as well.
Matt, Jack Shore doesn't have to go out there and do any media, but he did with Fight Night Picks and JHK. And the headline says, don't underestimate Welsh wrestling. He's going to finish Hunter Azur in the second round. So we'll see what happens there. Now, again, you don't ever want the interviews to bleed over into the video. We're talking about the odds for this one. Sure, open to minus 150. The line popped up for Azure. It's fallen slightly for sure. He's back to minus 151 for Azure. Open to plus 130. He's now at a plus 125. And if you look over at the overall Tapology votes, Matt, 1,052 of them, 90% sure and 60% by submission. That's what you're going with, is it not?
I am. I do like Shore quite a bit. Here's the thing. His game plan ties into what Hunter Azure doesn't do well. You talk about how Azure gets tired as the fight progresses. Normally, Jack Shore can tire his opponent out a lot earlier than just how they're naturally going to get tired on their own. So Hunter Azure already has suspect cardio. Now you're fighting a guy who has that grinding style, who is going to force you to work a lot throughout the fight. I like Jack Shore a lot. If it does go into the second or third round, I'm just going to keep on liking Jack Shore as this fight progresses.
Jack Shore says don't underestimate Welsh wrestling. And again, you get the Mason Jones, the Brett Johns. John Phillips is also from there, and his wrestling sucks. He's ask Hamzat Shamayev. But if you look at Jack Shore in his last fight, he fought a primary striker in Aaron Phillips. Now, Phillips was like the comeback kid story, been away forever. Jack Shore was a minus 800 favorite in that fight. Like, this kid's the real deal. I'm going with Jack Shore in this fight. I really do like him. Hunter Azure, great wrestling, great striking. If he keeps up a pace, you never know. But I like Shore here.
Yeah, I agree.
Both of us going with Wales. Jack Shore to get the win. Love the fight. Make sure you check out the interview from JHK. It's a great card. 15 total fights. So don't leave. You have to stick around. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. This fight is such a
why
type of fight. We have the Mad Titan himself, Jorgen De Castro, representing Cape Verde, taking on Jarjus Daniel. And if you've never heard of Jarjus Daniel, well, let me fill you in on him, because he hasn't fought in about 4.5 years. His last time out was a draw against Christian Colombo. Now, if you're a Fight Night Picks fan, you know Christian Colombo, because I seem to talk about him all the time. He's the best example of a real-life creative player, if there ever was one. And for Christian Colombo, his UFC tenure wasn't all that memorable. He was 36 when he came in. He was a Muay Thai fighter that grapples sometimes, and he lost forgettable fights. But he drew against Jarjus Daniel. And since that fight, Jarjus had three booked against Dmitry Probrzyets. He had Greg Hardy, and then he also had Tai Tuivasa. Unable to make those fights, he's supposed to fight Jorgen De Castro this coming weekend. Now, if you check the IG stories, Jarjus is in Vegas. He's landed. The man is in the building.
Jarjus has landed.
He will show up. And if you look at his overall body of work, I mean, he had a great record coming into the UFC. One no contest paired with five big wins by finish. One of them reaching the second, the rest of them in the first. And then he fought Daniel Milanchuk. And it's a technical majority decision for Milanchuk. You have to go back and watch it, because it was ended due to an illegal strike in the midpoint of the third round, where Milanchuk just kind of punched the top of the cup. Jarjus couldn't continue. We're going to the cards. Milanchuk won. If you go back and watch a lot of Jarjus Daniel tape, you're going to see one thing in particular. You thought Jorgen De Castro was predictable. Jarjus Daniel throws his right hand like it was a sledgehammer, and he just kind of comes in and throws it. And then he looks to wrench guys and pick them up and throw them, but UFC heavyweights are pretty big. Daniel Milanchuk, well, he was a champion outside of the UFC, and he had a decent run in the UFC.
He got toast choked by Stefan Struve. No, he didn't.
Stefan Struve, great guy. And then Christian Colombo, you had that weird majority draw where, if you go back and watch that one, there was a point deducted from Christian Colombo because he had an illegal knee at the start or the end of the first round where Daniel's fingertips were touching the mat. And for the Milanchuk fight and the Colombo fight, they had UFC VP, now UFC Hall of Famer, Mark Ratner tell you why these strikes were illegal and what could happen, because fighting back in 2016 was weird. So Jarjus has been off for 4.5 years. Listen, I went back and watched a lot of his tape to get back up to speed with him. But who the fuck knows what he's going
to
do in this
fight? I agree 100%. Here's the thing you have to take into consideration for Don Hill. His whole MMA career up until his layoff is less time than what his layoff has been. He fought for 4 years, and he's had an over 4 year layoff. So are we getting the same fighter? Are we getting a completely different fighter? There's just so many different versions of Jarjus that we could get in this fight. So I guess I'll talk about Jorgen De Castro, because I know what I can get from him.
So from Jorgen De Castro, this is a guy that we're feeding a fed horse at this point. And if you're new to Fight Night Picks, well, thank you. Craig Allen, Matt Allen, we appreciate you. Thanks for tuning in. Toss us a like and tune in to Question Mark Kicks on Saturday. But to get to the meat of the bone, we cover fights in person. Like, we're MMA media. We're not just fans here. And we go down and cover New England fights in Maine. Jorgen De Castro fought with New England fights, and he fought a guy by the name of Ross Hilton. Now, Ross had good success over with Bellator. He had a win over Rudy Shafroth, who was kind of making moves at one point. All that to say, when I got ready for Jorgen to fight with NEF, I went back and looked at the record. Not great. He beat William Knight. He lost to William Knight. Beat him in a Muay Thai bout. Lost to him as an amateur. He had a bad amateur record. He was 2-4. And then he came into pro MMA, and he just kept winning. And then he fought on Contender Series. And I thought, well, Alt Meeks is going to beat the brakes off him. Nope. Jorgen hit him with that crazy leg kick, dropped him, finished him. And then he goes to UFC 243, and he finishes the hometown guy in Justin Taffa.
He didn't close his eyes and throw a massive overhand, but still, it did land. And that's the thing about Jorgen. He did just keep on getting better. It wasn't the case of, oh, I got this loss, and now I look a lot worse. He just kept on scrapping, and he has gotten to the UFC. And I do think he will continue to improve from the last two fights that we've seen him. Because that Greg Hardy fight, and I'm crossing my fingers too, in the Greg Hardy fight, I'm sure a lot of you guys remember it, he was landing those leg kicks. It was going really well for Jorgen. He was the faster of the two. He was landing good strikes, and then he had that weird foot injury where he broke his foot, and he sort of walked around the rest of the fight and didn't throw anything. And that's the weird thing about Jorgen De Castro. He's a very good striker, and as heavyweights go, I always liken his striking a little bit to Tai Tuivasa, because Jorgen De Castro is a very good athlete, even for the size of him. And he's a very fast fighter, too. He has great hand speed and great kick speed when he lets his hands go. That's my big issue with Jorgen De Castro. When you watch him fight, his technique's really good, and when he does throw a combination, he will land on his opponent. But the issue is the output. If his output was a little bit better, I do think he'd be able to land a lot more of his power shots over the top. And if you go back to the Carlos Felipe fight, I love Carlos Felipe. No one outside of Carlos Felipe's family has ever said that until me at this very moment right now. But their fight, Felipe just kind of mirrored Jorgen at range, and then when he really needed to go to the clinch work, he was able to back up Jorgen De Castro. That's my big issue with De Castro in this fight. If Gergis comes in here looking like the Gergis of old, maybe, if he is going to go for takedowns and is pressuring forward, it's not like De Castro keeps his ground. He does have a bit of Tyron Woodley in him, where he'll just back up. He'll let his opponents back him up and back him up.
And it worked for him against Justin Taffa.
Exactly.
And in a fight against Danio, I would assume that's why, and to tip the hand, I mean, Jorgen De Castro, big favorite in this fight. And I was halfway surprised when I saw the odds, considering the way the last two performances went. You look at Jorgen De Castro, open to minus 250, he's minus 289 right now. For Daniel, open to plus 205, he's now plus 228. And to get back to your point, you look at the votes on Tapology, 1,041 of them, 86% De Castro, 78% by knockout. We haven't seen Gergis Daniel in years. It's been 4.5 years. And to me, it's like, listen, You're fishing for bass one day, and you keep casting, and you're not catching anything. Eventually, you just cut bait, and you go home and buy a sandwich at Subway on the way home. Why is Gergis Daniel still in the UFC? Like, what does he have over them?
He's got Dana White on film, I'm assuming. I'll just leave it at that. It's a weird fight. Listen, if I could not make a prediction, I wouldn't. This is the one fight. Again, when your layoff is longer than what your career was in the first place, that's like if after Jordan won his first three titles and took an 18-year break in between and then came back and won three more. It just doesn't make any sense, the layoff that he's had and the fact that he is still fighting at the UFC level. But also, Jorgen De Castro does a lot of things that I don't really like at the heavyweight range. I'm going to pick Jorgen. But I gotta be honest, I have no idea what to expect from Donho in this fight.
And for those reasons, I'll slightly side with Jorgen De Castro. But again, out of Gergis Daniel, the pressure, if he can work a takedown, he can definitely win this fight. I mean, these odds are stupid. If you came back on Saturday and we lose this one, I wouldn't be surprised in the least. The odds are silly. The fighters are maybe not UFC quality. It's just an absolute oddity here.
I have zero confidence in this pick, if you guys couldn't tell going into this. But yeah, it's a weird fight between two fighters that I have no idea which version I'm going to get out of either one. So I'll slightly slide with Jorgen De Castro. But if there was ever a pop and popcorn fight, it is this one.
Matt, never thought I'd say that. Pop and popcorn, bring it out for Gergis Daniel, the Man Mountain.
Ooh.
And the Mad Titan himself, Jorgen De Castro. We're both going with Fall River, Massachusetts, Jorgen De Castro to get the win. Really looking forward to this fight. We have a great card between the man himself, Marvin Vettori, and short notice replacement Kevin Holland stepping in for Darren Till. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Neat booking, Matt, at lightweight. We have the Bull, John McDessie, representing Montreal, Quebec, Canada, taking on Chile's Ignacio Bahamondes. His nickname is La Jaula. And if you've ever heard that, I've heard it in Combate broadcast before, and it went way over my head. Ignacio Bahamondes' nickname in English is The Cage. And if you're John McDessie, you're probably going to think, like, the Cage, like La Cage, which is a restaurant in Quebec. La Cage au Spa. They got great wings, great pizza, great entertainment. La Cage au Spa. But in a fight like this, it's really interesting. John McDessie just celebrated his 10th year with the UFC. That doesn't happen very often. And in his last fight, he took on Francisco Trinaldo in the card where Brazil was closing. And he lost that fight handily by decision. And by John McDessie's own account, his leg was giving up on him. Like, it was starting to buckle. He had to come back and have ACL surgery in Canada. And that's the really big talking point for me in this fight for John McDessie. If John McDessie was coming into a fight against Ignacio Bahamondes even a couple of years ago, I'd be hot and heavy all over John McDessie. But he had ACL surgery. Ew. And in an interview with the great Canadian James Lynch with Pub Sports, James pressed John on the injury and he said, when did you get back to training? And John kind of got around it a little bit and then he came back to it. The response was like mid-February after the New Year's. Man, I don't like that. Like, he's been off for a long time. That Trinaldo fight, if we go back and look at that, was 11 months and 3 weeks ago. So almost a full year ago, he had ACL surgery. And oh, by the way, John McDessie's been a guy that's trained out of TriStar in the past. He's been in GSP camps before. He's trained at Rufus Sport with Pettis and so on and so forth. If you look, and this is tough, you got to watch the interviews to get this knowledge. He's training out of MMA Lab right now in Arizona. He's going to have Benson Henderson in his corner for this fight, as well as Javier Torres. I like that. Like, listen, MMA Lab's making moves and starting grooves, just like Fight Ready. I mean, Arizona's really starting to get some great fighters great coaches together. So it is a great gym. John McDessie's almost 36. Major ACL surgery. It scares me off a little bit. And for John McDessie, a guy that in his overall 17 UFC fights, he has landed zero takedowns. Zero takedowns. He is a striker if there ever was a striker. Ignacio Bahamondes weighed in 168.5 his last fight at welterweight. And he's been a welterweight before. He was a skinny welterweight. Now he's going back down to lightweight. He's 6 foot friggin' three. Who are you? James Vick? Will Chope? I mean, Will Chope in a few weeks is going to be fighting two guys with Fight Circus. Is that going to be Ignacio Bahamondes one day? I don't know. But Matt, we've seen the striking out of Ignacio, a guy that trains at a VFS academy with Bilal Muhammad, so on and so forth. It's such an interesting fight. There's a huge question mark for McDessie. And I've seen Bahamondes at 55 before in his way up. There's so many question marks.
I'm really glad you brought up John McDessie's ACL, because here's the thing. My Twitter DMs are full of people saying, hey, stop talking about ACLs. MMA is not basketball. But here's the thing. John McDessie is 36 years old, basically. He's going to turn 36 in 3 weeks. You're the same age as LeBron James and you tore your ACL. If LeBron tore his ACL, everyone in the world on TV would say that it's over for him. He's never going to compete again. John McDessie openly admitted that he barely trained for almost 9 months leading up to this fight. Nina Ansaroff had a kid, and now she's fighting, and I'm more confident in her training regime leading up to her fight against Mackenzie Dern. There just are a lot of question marks around John McDessie, and I like what you brought up. He is not a wrestler whatsoever. When I think of John McDessie, he is that great striker. The thing is, he's a really weird striker, because I don't think he has great power by any means, and he doesn't really have the best output of all time. He just kind of has average at both. Now, he's a very technically sound fighter, and the one thing I always do like about John McDessie, he always has his hands in a very good defensive place. He's great at moving his hands out, moving them down. I know that seems like a small wrinkle, but it's true. Good MMA defense isn't something that you see that often, but for John McDessie, he does do a great job of keeping his head defended. And I know I kind of made fun of him before this, but the Ross Pearson fight, Ross Pearson nowhere near his prime, but it was just a great fight. And if you have a fight of the night, it means that it was competitive on both sides. But the thing that set John McDessie apart in that fight was his ability to land on Ross Pearson and not get hit in return. And that's something McDessie does very well. My issue going into this fight is, if you're only really fighting on one leg, and I'm going to bring up another basketball reference, Tim Duncan. I never saw Tim Duncan play in his prime. I can openly admit that. I saw Tim Duncan win a title, but the later half of his career, he was really only playing on one leg because he had so many injuries. He was just that good that he could still be an all-time great. I don't think John McDessie is that transcendent talent that even if you do have a major injury at this age, it won't affect you. I think his style will hide some of what that ACL reconstruction might have taken away from him. I like the fact that he doesn't go for a lot of takedowns because that's a lot of explosion that goes on your joints, on your ligaments, and McDessie might not have that same explosion that we sort of were used to in his earlier UFC tenure, but that's the other thing about McDessie. this fight is really going to prove how much MMA experience matters in a fight. Because for Ignacio, you had mentioned it, he's the taller guy, he's the taller striker. And that is what I kind of want to bring up when I talk about McDessie's ability to get in and get out. He can do that against smaller fighters and against fighters who are around his size. When he does fight taller, rangier strikers, they pick him apart at range. And I know the example I'm about to bring up might not be a great one. Go back and look at Sean McDessie versus Cowboy Cerrone. That's one of the worst fights of all time and one of the most one-sided fights of all time. McDessie should have been in there. It was a massive mismatch to begin with. But you look at what Cowboy was able to do to him. And I don't think Ignacio Bahamondes is near where Cowboy was in his prime at 155. But just from a physical standpoint and their size, they do match up very well at 155. And I do think the range of Bahamondes will give McDessie a lot of issues. Because McDessie's game does involve him taking a few shots, although he is good defensively, but walking into range and being sound enough defensively to not get hurt as he gets into range. I just don't know if he's going to be able to do that against the much younger and much rangier striker in Ignacio.
If you go look at Ignacio's last fight, he took on a guy in Edson Gomez that was really like if George Costanza was a fighter. He's 5'8" and weighed 174 pounds. Like, he woke up on the couch and decided, you know what? Screw the Cheetos. We're fighting
Who's
today.
The catcher for the Blue Jays?
Alejandro Kirk. Kind of like that. 5'7", 265. Ooh. But in a fight like this for Ignacio Bahamondes, I talked about it. I mean, Valley Flow Striking Academy. You've got Luis Taylor, former PFL champ. You've got Bilal Muhammad, Juliana Pena. You've got Macy Barber there as well. Like, there's a lot of good talent. But if you watch Ignacio fight, he's very much a kickboxer. Which is why I say, for John McDessie a few years ago, probably would have picked apart Ignacio Bahamondes. And if you look at Bahamondes, for a guy that has 35, 36 pro or kickboxing fights, amateur pro, what have you, he's defensively a little flawed. He gets hit. He got hit clean by Gomez. I've seen him get hit clean before. You look at the 5-on-in. He lost a few fights ago to Salvador Becerra over with Combate. That was a year and 3 months ago by decision. Before that, again, level competition, Hugo Flores, 7-1. Javier Reyes Sacedo, 0-3. But again, you like to see finishes. He beat Chris Breezy with LFA by decision. And listen, Chris Brown in MMA, not that Chris Breezy. Does he have the dance moves on the outside? Maybe. But you know when you fight Chris Brown, he's always going to give you a good fight. And he's the type of guy that can counter-strike on the outside and kind of... He understands energy in a fight. And I know I'm starting to go down a Robin Black rabbit hole. But he understands, like, I can roll with the punches and counter-strike back. That was a really good fight if you want to go back and see it. McDessie could definitely fight like Brown did in that fight against Bahamondes. Again, it was a split. I had it 2 rounds for Bahamondes to the 1 for Brown. But in this fight, again, 2 years ago, I would have had McDessie overwhelmingly. But the ACL scares me. The odds, McDessie opened a plus 100. He's now plus 156. For Bahamondes, opened a minus 120. He's now a minus 191. Bahamondes, big favorite in this one. McDessie's been off for a while. He also has a beard now. He's going to have, like I said, Javier Torres in the corner as well as Benson Henderson. And again, we've talked about the MMA lab time and time again about the level of training partner there and so whatever you can get out of those guys there. The other thing for John McDessie, you talked about it. He's fourth all-time in lightweight significant strike defense at 70.4% behind Miles Jury, Frankie Edgar, and Nasrat Haqparast. And you mentioned it. This guy's so good defensively, but can he do it in a fight where he's definitely going to get pressured here?
I don't think he can. That's my issue. Against taller fighters, he does tend to struggle. Even look back at the Trinaldo fight, and I know he thought he won that fight. He thought it was a close fight.
And he had the knee injuries going into it.
But it is an issue. As long as you don't plant your feet in front of John McDessie, you can evade some of his strikes. I know I talk about how good he is defensively, and you think about him as that primary striker, but his punches don't have the biggest amount of pop on the end of them. If you are a guy in Bahamondes who can just stay at range, pick him apart as he comes in, and make sure you move your feet so you don't get backed up towards the cage, I think you should be able to win this. If John McDessie, let's say the legs are 100%, everything's good, maybe he does have a path to victory. I just don't like the output from McDessie, and if he can't get to Ignacio, I don't really know how he's going to be able to land with power.
1,030 total votes on Tapology. 62% have Bahamondes to win, 62% by knockout. The 38% that have McDessie, 79% by decision. I'm going to go with the younger fighter here out of Chile with La Jaula, Ignacio Bahamondes, to get the win. Again, I think he's going to pressure the fight. I think he's going to throw a fair amount of kicks. He switches stance really quick and on the fly. He also changes levels quite a bit, too. I like the striking out of Bahamondes, and there's too many question marks around McDessie. Hey, maybe the bull proves me wrong in this one. Perhaps. That would be kind of neat. But Matt, both of us going with Chile's Ignacio Bahamondes to get the win. Really looking forward to the entire card. We have 15 fights slated for this Saturday, including a great main event between Marvin Vettori and Kevin Holland. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Really looking forward to our next fight, Matt. It's at women's bantamweight. We have the immortal Norma Dumont, and no, it's not Matt Brown. Other people can have the nickname the immortal, taking on cold-blooded Erin Blanchfield. And if you're a fan of MMA and you've been following Invicta, 21-year-old, almost 22-year-old Erin Blanchfield, somebody that has definitely been on your radar coming into the UFC. If you look at the five on in, only one loss. It was by split decision to Tracy Cortez. And in a bizarro world, if Blanchfield beat Cortez, Cortez would go on to fight Maria Agapova and then end up in the UFC. For Blanchfield, she loses that fight. She beats a fighter by the name of Gabriella Golfin over at CFFC. She beats Victoria Leonardo, that's now in the UFC, finished her about a year ago. And she just beat Brogan Walker Sanchez about 8 months ago and looked amazing in that fight. And the thing for Erin Blanchfield, I've talked enough about that Tracy Cortez fight. I thought she won it. You go back and watch it. It's a split decision loss. I had Blanchfield winning two rounds handily. She could have even won three. I mean, she won that fight. And I saw Sean Bitter tweet it out there the other day. And I saw Keith Schilling follow up with a response. So I threw the response out there too. In a weird world, Erin Blanchfield would already be in the UFC. The weird thing about this call-up is she has been a flyweight through and through. She's taken this fight at bantamweight against Norma Dumont, that came into the UFC with a lot of question marks around her. Fought at featherweight against Megan Anderson. The right cross landed.
I was going to say, you might know her from that one Megan Anderson highlight.
And so Dumont got finished in that one. She comes out at 135 and fights Ashley Evans-Smith. And other than somebody that likes to take things from porches, she got a big win over Ashley Evans-Smith. I mean, Evans-Smith, like, checked the kick. She kind of smirked in that fight. And then it was all Dumont after that. And if you look at Norma Dumont, brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. She's a black belt in Sanda. And you'd think, well, how does Sanda really work? I mean, Chinese kickboxing, a little bit of the work with the takedowns. Works pretty good for Norma Dumont. I mean, her striking, very powerful. She's the type that's going to strike to get into the clinch, to get it to the ground. That doesn't really play into the game plan of somebody that would want to fight Erin Blanchfield, especially on short notice. Blanchfield is a wizard on the ground. She's a very accredited purple belt from Henzo Gracie's in New York. She spent some time training at Cordoba Wrestling. Caitlin Chukagian, a training partner. It's just weird that you'd come in at 35 against somebody that missed weight. Dumont in her last fight weighed 139.5 against Ashley Evans-Smith. And I get it. Take your shot. Blanchfield's getting her shot here. It's just a weird one. Does she have a chance? Sure she does. She's 21. She's one of those hyped up prospects like we've seen with Barber and so on and so forth. I really, really think there's a high ceiling on Erin Blanchfield. The trouble is, her striking's just not there yet.
So the reason I was so confident that Sean O'Malley was going to beat Thomas Almeida was because I watched enough boxing to know when the promotion wants one guy to win. And you can just kind of tell stylistically, okay, that's a good fight for this prospect. This is a terrible fight for their prospect, and it doesn't make any sense to me matchmaking-wise. Because like you had said, you have a fighter who's going up in weight in her UFC debut, so there's already going to be some octagon jitters, if you will, against a fighter who's big in her original weight class at 135.
And the reason why you have Blanchfield on short notice, it was originally supposed to be Norma Dumont, Bia Malecki. Malecki out of this fight. But yeah, it's just, it's an odd bit of matchmaking.
They're not doing the prospect any favors. And for Blanchfield, there was a little bit of resistance you threw up against me, but I'm still going to say it. Blanchfield's a very good grappler, but my issue is, A, the size discrepancy between these two, and also, you're not going to out-grapple Norma Dumont the way that she might be able to out-grapple some other women at flyweight. Because the reason that Erin Blanchfield's so good at flyweight is she's extremely physically strong, but she also is very technical on the ground. She doesn't do these massive passes from guard and then try to jump into mount. She will be very smart about, okay, I'm going to pressure down the knee, get into half guard, and then I can establish my positions from there. My issue with that is, I don't know if Blanchfield has the wrestling to take down Dumont, and Dumont does have the wrestling to take down Blanchfield. My other issue is, Blanchfield, if she is taken down for any period of time, and if Dumont's on top of her, even look at Dustin Poirier's Instagram page. I don't know exactly what strongman he was grappling with, but you can tell Dustin Poirier, a very good black belt on the mat, and he was like, okay, I want to see if I can get up off this guy. He does an okay job, but at a certain point, the size will pay out. Listen, that guy, I think Eddie Hall is his name. I don't really know the strongman world all that well. He was twice as big as Poirier. It's not like Dumont has that big of a size advantage, but every little pound really does matter. And that's why when fighters miss weight, but they're a grappler, it seems to help them a lot more than if they miss weight and they're a striker. Because if you miss weight and you're a striker, it means your chin might not be great, you had a really bad weight cut, and you can get cracked. If you're a grappler and you miss weight, you're going to be that much heavier on top of your opponent. And that is the sole reason why I'm confident about Norma Dumont in this fight. I just think if she's able to get on top for any period of time, the amount of exhaustion that Erin Blanchfield will feel off her back trying to escape, trying to get a submission, it's going to be so much that I just don't know what fighter is going to be left in that second and third round. She could definitely prove me wrong, but that is such a big question mark for me in this fight.
For Dumont, we talked about this in the Impic Sanganai fight. This guy that's always fought at middleweight, I think he had a one-off at light heavyweight. He's moving down to 170 for the first time. For Dumont, you go back at it. You look at the Mariana Moraes fight that she had with Shuto. That one was at bantamweight. Then she fought Anderson at featherweight. Missed weight against Ashley Evans-Smith by a lot. And now she's coming in here against Erin Blanchfield, where it was originally supposed to be Bea Malecki, a striker. Now you get Blanchfield, a grappler. And when that paper came across the table, I'm sure there was no hesitation. You look at Norma Dumont on her Instagrams right now, and sure, pictures can be deceiving. But if it's week after week after week of Norma Dumont with like a six-pack looking in great shape, I'm not worried in the slightest about her weight cut for this fight. Because if you've seen her fight, when she fought Anderson, did she have a six-pack? No. And listen, you're going to rehydrate. You're probably not going to have it anyway. But if you saw her in the Ashley Evans-Smith fight, and now you see her, the way that she looks right now, she looks great for a fight like this. Blanchfield looks good, too. I mean, she posted a picture right after she signed the contract. Do I think she's going to have a hard time at 35? No. But there's, as Corey Anderson would say, and he's got a big fight coming up soon, there's levels to this one. And it's just tricky for me to go with Blanchfield, even though, again, I think she's a great prospect. This is a really tough ask.
But if you're the UFC, this one doesn't make any sense to me. Why don't you just say, hey, Jillian Robertson, want to fight Erin Blanchfield or anyone at flyweight? It's not like flyweight's the deepest division in the world. So you could have an excuse to get her in that kind of 20 to 15 range, her first fight. Then you win that fight. You can start to fight people in the rankings or really start to pick your own fight. For me, it just is really odd matchmaking on the company's part.
I just want to say this too about Erin Blanchfield. We talk about the grappling, the Henzo's connection, the fact that she wrestles at Cordoba. She's got a really good training partner in Caitlin Chookagian. All things that bode well at flyweight. Oh, wow. If you look at Erin Blanchfield and striking, go back to the Leonardo fight. I mean, listen, Menno Fiorito, very high level striker, beat Leonardo. If you look at Erin Blanchfield's fight, she throws a head kick that kind of wobbles Leonardo. She's able to strike her way through it. And then in the second round, well, she just keeps doing it, and Leonardo has no defense for it. For Norma Dumont, I liken this fight to the fight that you had between Livia Souza and Amanda Lemos. And you had Lemos super, super powerful, really good with the takedown. She can get backed up. She can still strike, just like Norma Dumont. For Blanchfield, great at grappling. Her striking, it's a work in progress. And when she gets her hands going, her head stays on the center line. She just moves forward. I could see her landing into a shot. If we have a look, Matt, just quick at the odds. I mean, Dumont, big favorite. Open to minus 250, now minus 251 for Blanchfield. Plus 175 up to a plus 200 right now. And the Tapology votes, what are they going to be at? 763 of them, because this fight's still kind of coming together. It was just announced a couple days ago. 70% Dumont with 88% by decision. If you haven't told or haven't guessed already, I've got Dumont here.
I like the Souza-Lemos comp. It's not one that I thought of. I can openly admit that. And yeah, no, I do like Norma. I think, she is the much bigger of the two, and that does matter. Especially in women's MMA, you don't cut that much weight. So the fact that she is moving up in weight is going to be that big of a difference. I like Norma Dumont striking a lot more than I like Erin Blanchfield. It will be interesting if Blanchfield's able to get the takedown herself and get on top of Norma Dumont. It will be interesting to see how that kind of plays out. But even at that point, I like Dumont's scrambles. I like her ability to get back up to the feet. I like Norma Dumont.
Matt, both of us going with Brazil's Norma Dumont to get the win. Really looking forward to the entire card. 15 fights headlined by, well, there's Arnold Allen taking on Sadiq Youssef. You also have Marvin Vettori taking on Kevin Holland. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. This is arguably my favorite fight on this card. We have it at lightweight between a couple of bangers. Scott Hot Sauce Holtzman. Boy, it's hot. Taking on Mateusz Gamer Gamrot. And listen, from the former KSW double champ at featherweight and lightweight, Mateusz Gamrot's been there and done that. My favorite win on his record, maybe the Kleber Kuike Arabs fight, but he's got three of them against Norman Park. Two wins, 1-0 contest. The last one, really just straight up all of them. Tons of bad blood. I mean, Norman Park usually brings it, but if you go and watch, I mean, Mateusz Gamrot, the striking is there. He can really put on an insane amount of pressure. He can throw a ton of volume. He's got a bit of power in his hands. We saw him really kind of exposed against Guram Kutateladze in his last fight, where maybe some of those wars have taken over. This guy that was 17-0 coming into the UFC, and that was his only taste of defeat in pro mixed martial arts, was against Kutateladze. And it wasn't that long ago. But if you want to be specific, you go back and watch it. Kutateladze definitely won the first two. He's coming in on relatively short notice. It was originally supposed to be Magomed Mustafayev, which I hope we get someday.
Great.
But in the third round, Gamrot changed it up. He made that adjustment where, yes, when I'm in southpaw, I might be looking more for the takedown. When I'm in orthodox, I'm going to strike. He went straight for the takedowns and the grappling, and that was where he shone. And if you look at it, I mean, this is a guy that was a European ADCC grappling champ. He has a loss in grappling 2019 to Gary Tonin, 7 minutes, rear naked choke. No shame in that. I love the grappling out of Gamrot. I love the complete game out of him. For Scott Hot Sauce Holtzman, other than the heartbeat Dustin Poirier's Louisiana style that I have, this is a guy that spent 4 years at the University of Tennessee. Was he cow tipping? Was he bull roping? Balling? Nope. Not balling. He was playing hockey. And if there's anything I like, it's playing hockey. And this is a guy that also had a pro roller hockey career, which I've considered at points in my life.
Now,
low points.
I'm just going to let this out there. If you say he plays hockey, it makes him sound pretty tough. If you end that statement by saying he then played roller hockey, it takes away all the coolness of him playing college hockey.
Still pretty cool. But if for Scott Hot Sauce Holtzman, hockey player, and you don't hear of a lot of hockey players from Knoxville, Tennessee, but this is a guy that spent time at Gym O. Now, I have to say, like a lot of fighters on this card, he has switched gyms, and I'll get into it a little bit later on. But I love this matchup. Two really all-action type of guys here.
This is a really good fight for Mateusz Gamrot to really figure out how good he is and to see if he did leave too much of himself in KSW. It's my whole Thomas Almeida theory where you get into so many wars before you get to the UFC. Trying to get the UFC to acknowledge you. You have all these crazy fights. And when they finally acknowledge you, you left too much of your gas in those sort of, I'm not going to call KSW a lesser promotion, but just not in the UFC. And for Gamrot, he did have a lot of crazy fights before he came over. And you look at that Guram fight, I think Guram Kutateladze is a handful for anyone at 155.
What do you think about Paddy Pimblett's chances against him?
I don't like them at all, if I'm being very honest. But the fact that Gamrot was able to eat his best shots. Did he go down? Yes, he did. He was dropped in that fight. And it was weird when you look at that, because it will kind of play into the maybe Gamrot could be slightly, maybe a little chinny, I don't know. Because if you look at the shots that Kutateladze lands on him, to drop him at least, he lands a lot of clean shots. But they're not the hardest shots. They're ones that are off weird parts of your head. And for me, when guys start getting knocked out, when they get hit kind of at the front of their head, normally on the side, it's never a great look going forward. But the great news for Gamrot is this is really just a chin check of a fight for him. Gamrot is quite a bit better than Scott Holtzman, technically, in really every aspect of MMA. The one thing I don't like about Gamrot is that if you, me, and Daniel Cormier all know that when he's southpaw, he likes to grapple, and when he's orthodox, he likes to strike, you can't beat guys in the top 15 like that. They're going to be able to expose that hole in your game, and they're just going to force you into becoming an orthodox fighter and make you strike. They're just going to kick your back leg like there's no tomorrow. But against Holtzman, he has good boxing, but my problem is people love to say Scott Holtzman has good boxing. He has good power in his hands, and he has good hands. If you have good boxing, it means that defensively you should be somewhat sound. And my issue with Scott Holtzman is he's a very hittable fighter, and I know a lot of you guys are probably going to say, oh, well, you're just looking at the Dariush fight. That's not true. Even go back to the Dong Hyung Ma fight. Dong Hyung Ma is not a great MMA fighter. He did not have the best of UFC
the maestro.
Fights. He has some entertaining fights, but he didn't have the most memorable UFC career. He dropped Scott Holtzman, and then of course Scott Holtzman was able to come back and knock him out pretty quick after. But the fact that you're getting into those crazy wars with guys who are no longer in the UFC, it's a little bit concerning. Do I think Gamrot could go out there and just out-wrestle Scott Holtzman? I do. But the thing about Gamrot is, let's say he does start to land a few shots on Scott Holtzman. Holtzman, he is in the best defensively. You can land on him. Then Gamrot might get too much confidence as a striker. And once that happens, that's going to open up the counter strikes of Scott Holtzman to really play a factor in this fight. I don't think it will get to that point. I just think it is an interesting wrinkle that if Gamrot's landing early, it might not be the best sign for him just overall in the fight. Personally, if you look at what Gamrot's able to do, the ability to go for takedowns on either side, on either leg, single legs, double legs, he can take you down from the clinch. And the It's not just the way that he chain wrestles. It's really important. He doesn't even stop wrestling once he gets the fight to the mat. Once he gets the fight to the mat, he's really good at control as well, so it's really hard to pop back up against him. Yes, some guys are able to just muscle their way to the feet, but the issue is, if you do that once, if you do that twice, you're going to be spent by that second and third round. And if Gamrot could just stick to the wrestling early on in this, I don't really know how Holtzman's going to win.
If you look at it for Scott Holtzman, he was a Jim O guy for the longest time. He's now out of the MMA lab, and if you go look at it on the Instagrams, John McDessie, James Nakashima with one championship. You got David Mashad with PFL, Bellator, UFC, all over the place. Benson Henderson. But the one guy that I love in Scott Holtzman's corner, and I'm not joking, is Magic Mike Hamill. And if you know anything about Mike Hamill, well, he had a split decision loss to Adam Borch that I thought he won. He also fought his tail off against Usman Nurmagomedov and got beat pillar to post. But he's tough as nails. And to train with a guy like that for Scott Holtzman, I do like it. He's got Augusto Mendez, his BJJ coach there too. As good as they get.
If you're going to talk about those training partners, Gamrot spent this training camp at American Top Team.
So he's been an American Top Team guy for a while. Let's go through the pictures. Masvidal, Poirier, Thiago Moises, Khrizhriev that we have on this card. We also have Barboza and Kyle Dake. Matt, what does Kyle do well?
Jiu-jitsu?
No, he just beat Jordan Burroughs at wrestling, and that was a really big deal.
There you
go. There's a lot of good things to like out of both these guys, but again, really like Mateusz Gamrot in this fight. If we have a look at the odds, Matt, I mean, not all that surprising, although, again, you look at it for Gamrot, he did lose his debut, but he is a decent-sized favorite in this one. He's about a minus 225 or thereabouts for Scott Holtzman, about a plus 185. And if we look at the total Tapology votes, 1,078 of them, 85% Gamrot, 74% by decision. I like Poland's Mateusz Gamrot in this one.
So I guess we both have Gamrot. I'll just end it on this. Do you think we will see Gamrot ever go to 145 in the UFC? Or do you think he's just
Shred
back?
City at 55.
I agree. I was just going to get your opinion. There we go. Yeah, no, I like Gamrot a lot.
Terrible question. Both going with Poland's Mateusz Gamrot to get the win. I love the fight, though. Hot sauce always brings it. Whether you're Jim Miller or Dunhyun Ma or even Benil Dariush. We'll see how he rebounds off that loss, off camp change. But again, I like Gamrot in this one. Should be a great fight. We got a great card. 15 fights. What's not to love? You got Marvin Vettori taking on Kevin Holland in the main event. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Some great interviews on the channel with Fight Night Picks. We've got Joe Selecki, Sasha Plotnikov, Kyle Daukaus, and the like. And Matt, Joe Selecki in the biggest fight of his life. He's taking on a childhood idol of his when he spent time in New Jersey, of you as well. And it's not Dan Miller. We're talking A10 Jim Miller. And Matt, for Jim Miller, I wrote it down. Overall in UFC lore, and this is regardless of weight class, what have you, Jim Miller's going to break a record that he ties with Donald Cerrone. He currently has 36 fights in the UFC. He's going for 37 this weekend. He's third for wins at 21. He's third with submission wins at 10. He's sixth with bonuses at 12. He's number one with submission attempts for 45. What hasn't Jim Miller done in the UFC? I'm going to talk about some of the fights, and these are losses in the UFC. Benson Henderson, Nate Diaz, Donald Cerrone, Benil Dariush, Dustin Poirier, Anthony Pettis. Jim Miller's been in there with some of the best fighters of all time, let alone lightweight.
Francisco Trinaldo.
Yikes. Massaranduba, been there and done that. 3-2 in the 5 on in. For Joe Selecki, he just continues to win. I get it. He has 2 losses on his record, and he has been finished in the past. This is going to be an interesting one, though, because we talked about Jim O. And because Sanganai has left, Scott Holtzman has left. Joe Selecki's still there with your number one ranked Bellator welterweight, John Salter, leading the charge. And for Joe Selecki, what a grappler he is. Holy smokes. His last time out against Austin Hubbard. Hubbard hadn't been submitted, really, at all like that. And Joe Selecki just rode the back for a few minutes and then just sunk in that rear naked choke. For Selecki, again, the 5 on in. Gilbert Patronicio with Ring of Combat. He beat Jacob Bond. Listen, we've seen Jacob Bond before. I've seen him on the regional scene. Beat James Wallace on Contender Series, beat old Matt Wyman, and that's a win these two guys hold in common is Matt Wyman. One of them beat him when it mattered, and one of them didn't. And for Joe Selecki, he beat Austin Hubbard, fellow prospect, in a very interesting fight. For Jim Miller, listen, if you have porous grappling whatsoever, if you make mistakes, we saw that in his last win when he fought Roosevelt Roberts, the up-and-coming prospect that's kind of faltered lately. But Roberts stumbles, Miller goes in and submits him. But in his last fight, it was a Miller fight in the first round, and then in the last two, it wasn't.
So Jim Miller's a really interesting character, because I can basically tell you everything he's ever going to go for in the run of a fight. There's a lot of overhands, there's a lot of inside leg kicks, one of the early adopters of calf kicks, and then just his jiu-jitsu is absurd. My issue with Jim Miller, and I'm not even going to call him A10 Jim Miller, I'm going to call this rendition Lyme disease Jim Miller, because ever since he's got...
Oh, that's mean.
But it's true. Ever since he's got Lyme disease, there has been a difference in the cardio of Jim Miller, and that just is the truth. And I know that's something that you can't get over as time progresses. It's something that he said doesn't affect him like it once originally did. But his cardio is the one thing, and of course he's getting older too, which doesn't help, but his cardio is the one thing, like you had brought up. Early on, let's say you were an up-and-coming prospect, you were a great striker. The last guy you ever want to fight is Jim Miller, because he's going to take you down and submit you. But we're starting to see that as Jim Miller is getting a little bit older, there are a lot of miles on the gas tank. He is almost 38 years old. The gas tank's not what it once was. And what Jim Miller, the stage that he's in now kind of reminds me of the stage that Joe Lozon was in the last little stage of his career. I know Joe Lozon and him are always going to be tied together because of the crazy fights that they've had, but Jim Miller at this stage can give you that one round of grappling explosion, and then it falls off. And it hurts to say, because I love Jim Miller, one of my favorite fighters of all time. I love watching Jim Miller fight. But unless Jim Miller is just really dedicated to the calf kick and some wrestling, he is going to get tired as the fight progresses. Whereas if you look at Jim Miller, anytime I'll say before UFC 200, let's say, it was, I'm just going to move forward. I'm going to march forward, lots of pressure, lots of wrestling. And if I take you down, you better watch your neck because I'm going to take it. That's not the guy that we're seeing anymore. And it could be age, it could be injuries, it could be a whole number of things. But we're not getting that same level of Jim Miller. I think we're going to learn a lot about Joe Selecki in this fight because, of course, he's a good grappler. And it's not, there's something we talk about where it's one thing to beat a guy, but it's another thing to beat a guy at what he does well. If you out-grapple Jim Miller, you're a much better fighter than if you knock out Jim Miller, because I'm going to learn a lot more about your overall game because of it. Let's say Joe Selecki goes in here and fights Jim Miller like he was able to fight Austin Hubbard, take the back with barely any resistance, just kind of ride him, see what's the best position, and then get in a submission. Then I'm ready to say Joe Selecki's ready for those like 25 to maybe not 15 yet, but those like 25 to 18 type range of fighters in the lightweight division. But you're going to learn a lot about a win over Jim Miller. And I do say this a lot. Beating Jim Miller can be the worst thing for some guy's career because you
beat... Like Scott Holtzman.
You beat Jim Miller and then it's never an easy fight for the rest of your UFC career because everyone still likes Jim Miller and everyone remembers how good he was. So you're only going to be known as, wow, you're that guy who beat Jim Miller. Well, now you're ready for X fighter who's really good at lightweight. I don't want them to do that with Joe Selecki, but I don't think it's the same Jim Miller that was sort of that tester before. I think it's a diminished version. And for that reason, I do like Joe Selecki quite a bit.
Jim Miller coming out of Miller Brothers MMA for Joe Selecki, again, Jim O, and you talk about the quality of guys there, but again, number one Bellator middleweight John Salter. What does John Salter do so well? Exactly what really both of these guys do. Joe Selecki a bit like a younger Jim Miller, only he more strikes to get into position for the takedown. He likes to go for some lower leg takedown as well, which, listen, you can get caught in a guillotine from Jim Miller. I mean, there's a lot of submissions that he can go for as you're pressuring him. I mean, Jim Miller is an all-timer. You don't need me to say that anymore. Selecki opened to minus 135. He's minus 236 right now. He's one of the second biggest mover on this card, a 43% clip. For Jim Miller, open to plus 115. He's now plus 189. And over on Tapology, 1,077 votes, 72% Selecki, 73% by decision. I like the younger Jim Miller in this fight, Joe Selecki. Again, I just love the game. And if you look at the overall body of work, again, you're beating guys that you should beat, and along the way, you're going to lose some of your fights. He lost to Nicholas Mata. He got knocked out by Mata. Mata's got his UFC debut coming up in a short bit, and he's taking on Demir Hadzovic in May. I had to look at it. And he lost to Cesar Balmaseda back at CFFC 65, which was in 2017. You're going to lose a fight like that, and Nicholas Mata is UFC ready. Since then, he's continued to win. Again, I've seen Jacob Bond fight before. Weird to see his name pop up. And that Zhu Enyanwu card with Chris Daukaus, great one. We're going to be talking about a Daukaus. But yeah, I really like Joe Selecki in this fight, and I think he's one of those guys, like a young up-and-comer, you need to watch out for. Miller on a bit of a decline. And again, I set it up. He had a great first round against Vince Pichel. Vince Pichel's a good fighter. You didn't know exactly what you were going to get. He had that motorcycle accident. He's also 37, 38 years old. Vince Pichel out-wrestled Jim Miller and totally nullified his game in the second and third round, where Miller couldn't really do anything. And you kept thinking, well, geez, Vince Pichel probably shouldn't get himself into these positions. And he made out just fine. I think the cardio, Selecki, it really plays a factor in this one. I like him in this fight.
Unless Jim Miller comes out in this fight like he did in the Clay Guida fight, crack him with an overhand and submit him quick. I just don't really see how he's going to be able to get it done. I like his grappling a lot, but again, with Selecki, it's not like you're just fighting a Roosevelt Roberts or a Scott Holtzman or levels of fighters like that who they can get submitted on their worst day. Joe Selecki, very sound grappler, offensively and defensively, and for that, I do like him in this fight.
Matt, both of us going with Joe Selecki to get the win. Really looking forward to the entire card. 15 fights. It's a headlining prelim. The overall headliner, Marvin Vettori taking on Kevin Holland. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Really interesting fight set to kick off our main card this weekend. We have Platinum Mike Perry taking on D-Rod, Daniel Rodriguez. Matt, when was the last time you heard of Mike Perry?
It's been a while, which is weird because normally his name is always in the headlines for positive or negative reasons.
Mostly negative.
It has been a while since we've heard from him.
And for Mike Perry, he's been around like a used car, but in this one, he's been training out of MMA Masters, and you see it, the Danny Chavez of the world, Miguel Baeza, Colby Covington, and maybe this is a new and improved version of Mike Perry. And if we got that, then maybe we're going to get the guy that has 4 performance bonuses in 14 UFC fights. How crazy is that? He's had 7 wins and 7 losses. And in those bonuses, we're talking Jake Ellenberger. We're talking, listen, losses to Vicente Luque, where his nose turns to butter. We're talking about Alex Reyes, who will never fight again in the UFC. And so on and so forth. The win over Alex Oliveira, the other one. For Daniel Rodriguez, he has the 1 performance bonus so far. And we've seen the same game plan from D-Rod. It is straight up kill or be killed. This is a guy at a BMF ranch in Syndicate MMA. On the Instagrams, he's hanging out with Donald Cerrone. Who else? Bongs. This was his last Instagram story. My bong matches my shoes. And he had a fancy bong and J Balvin Jordan 1s. Cool shoes. Maybe not what I'd be doing on Sunday night before a fight, Daniel.
Just
chilling. I get it. You can now, but like, Daniel, you're fighting Mike Perry. That's the biggest name you ever fought. And for Daniel Rodriguez, last time out, I had scored at 29-28 Rodriguez. He lost a decision to Nicholas Dalby. All 3 judges seeing it for Dalby in that one. It was a close fight, but it was one of those, did the pressure win out? Were they the more impactful strikes? I mean, Rodriguez did outstrike Dalby in that fight. It was a weird one for me. He could arguably be on a longer win streak. He could also be on a 2-fight losing streak because War Tyone gave him every single opportunity to fight against Dwight Grant, where he was dead to rights, finished, came back and finished Dwight Grant. Now you're taking on Mike Perry. It's tough to finish Mike Perry. He's not going to give out due to strikes. He'll let his nose turn to mush and he'll breathe out of his mouth, something that Sam Alvey can't typically do in an MMA fight. But in one like this, it's so interesting because for Rodriguez, he had such a great fight against Tim Means, MMA math. For Mike Perry, he looked lost when he fought Tim Means.
Cut his ears boxed in by my boy the Dirty Bird, and no one was happier about that performance than me. But this really is an odd fight, and there's a wrinkle of Mike Perry's game that doesn't get talked about, but it's the truth. Mike Perry is a good striker, and everyone thinks of him as a striker. When was the last time Mike Perry ever beat a primary striker? It's been a while.
Alex Oliveira?
Alan Jobin outstruck him on the feet. Far more technical, was able to hurt him early and then just stay at range. Santiago Ponzinibbio, a very technical striker. He will get into a brawl every now and then, don't get me wrong. But he was able to just outlast the sort of brutish strength of Mike Perry. And again, you look at the losses, Vicente Luque, Jeff Neal, Tim Means, all extremely technical strikers. When Mike Perry is at his best, it's weird. I actually think he's at his best when he's incorporated the takedown into his game, which is weird because we don't really see him do it that much. And the only fight we've ever really seen Mike Perry go for a takedown heavy game plan was the Mickey Gall fight, which is weird because you think, okay, well, if Mickey Gall has one chance to beat Mike Perry, he's going to have to take him down and submit him. But this is the thing. Mike Perry hasn't beat a decent fighter in a long time. Alex Oliveira was the last time he beat, I'll even say relevant MMA fighter, and I hate to trash on Mickey Gall this much, but let's be honest. Mickey Gall's not a UFC caliber fighter, and beating him by unanimous decision doesn't prove to me that you're still one of those 25 to 15 welterweights who can go out there and have a great fight no matter who they're in the cage with. Because for a while, that's what Mike Perry was. He had a close fight, if you will, with Luque. I know it was a split decision, but he made a fairly good account of himself. He just ate a lot of power shots as the fight progressed. But then you look at what Jeff Neal was able to do to him. And D-Rod can't throw kicks like Jeff Neal can, so it's one thing you won't have to worry about. But you said Mike Perry can eat a lot of shots. Not in that fight, he couldn't. He ate a straight left and a head kick and went down quick. And I understand we're talking about some of the better finishers in the division, but my problem with Mike Perry is that everyone talks about, oh, he's got this great power, his striking's good. he never outstrikes other primary strikers, and that really does worry me, because in this fight, he's not really facing another primary striker who is really technical and has that pretty kind of striking, if you will, like an Alan Jobin. D-Rod will brawl with you a little bit, and that's what's such a question mark for me, because if Mike Perry brawls with D-Rod, I think Rodriguez hits harder, I think he can be more technical, but I do think he leaves his chin extremely high in the air. He's got this weird tendency to kind of, he throws with his waist almost, and he does leave his chin really high. It looks very much like Luke Rockhold when he throws punches, and that worries me. If he fights a guy moving forward, let's say he does fight a Luke one day, that's going to be an issue. But fighting Mike Perry, I think those issues won't be as apparent, but Mike Perry can still capitalize on some of those.
I mean, listen, if you look at it for Mike Perry, I think the great training partner, and you talk about it with MMA Masters, there's a lot of great wrestlers there now, but the coaching staff as well. Miguel Baeza gets you pretty well ready for this one. I mean, Baeza's got decent defensive submissions, decent takedown defense, Covington for the wrestling offense. Boom goes the dynamite. Maybe you get Daniel Rodriguez like a fish out of water. The only thing is, and for Daniel Rodriguez, a lot of defensive submissions, but he understands if he gets a fighter hurt, he can submit them. Now, for Rodriguez, we talked about it. Syndicate, you have that connection with John Wood and the team over there. The BMF stuff, it is what it is. I mean, this guy is part of the entourage of Donald Cerrone. There's a lot of pictures of him out there on the internet. But Yair Rodriguez in the camp as well. Sasha Palatnikov that's on this card. There's a lot to like. For Rodriguez, yeah, leaves his head out there big time. And he's one of those guys that plants with his waist and starts to throw like a baseball player swinging a bat. So it'll be interesting to see which game plan we get out of Perry. Because if we get a wrestle-heavy game plan, this could be a totally different fight that a lot of people probably wouldn't see coming.
No, I do agree. But again, for Mike Perry, you look at the areas he has had the most success in his recent fights. He even did take down Alex Oliveira. That's my point. For Mike Perry, you really have to be dedicated to that. Because if people just know that Mike Perry is going to be that striker who's going to go out there and brawl with them, all you have to do is throw a jab and move your feet and you can beat that fighter. But if you're dealing with a guy who will brawl with you on the feet, but he will also mix in the takedown, it's another variable that you're at least going to have to consider. And with Rodriguez, if he is leaving his hands down and someone fakes the takedown Chad Mendes style and comes over top with an overhand, your chin is going to be more than exposed. So I do think that there are a lot of defensive holes from Daniel Rodriguez that fighters in the future will be able to take advantage of. I just don't think Mike Perry's going to be one of those guys.
Daniel Rodriguez opened a minus 110. He's a minus 174 right now. Mike Perry opened minus 110. He's now a plus 143. And over on Topology, total votes, Matt, we haven't seen them. 1,132 total votes, 73% Rodriguez, 47% of the fans have him to win by decision, 43% by knockout. For the 23% of fans that have Mike Perry to win, 43% by decision, or 49% by knockout. So people put chunk of change on Rodriguez. The fans have Rodriguez. You tipped your hand, you're going Rodriguez.
I like Rodriguez. I don't know if we'll get a finish. I think both guys' cardio are pretty much comparable. I don't think either guy's known as a cardio king. If anything, I'd probably give Mike Perry a slight edge in cardio. Just I've seen him go three hard rounds with really good fighters before. And it's not a knock against D-Rod. It's just something I haven't seen him do yet in his career. I'm not saying he can't. Again, it's just Mike Perry's proven that to me. I'm going to pick D-Rod. I think he'll be able to land a big shot early. I don't know if he'll be able to get the finish, but I do like Rodriguez.
To me, it's over 1.5. That would be the official pick for me. I like That's Rodriguez nice. In a fight like this, but if Mike Perry decides, hey, I'm Mike Perry wrestler now, it could be a totally different fight. So the official pick, and I've done this before, over 1.5, you've got Daniel Rodriguez, and I'll give you the pick on question mark kicks. But again, I do like Rodriguez in the fight, but I'm throwing it out there. The over 1.5. I love the fight. I have it as a possible fight of the night. Perry Rodriguez, great one. In our main event, you have Marvin Vettori taking on Kevin Holland, coming in on short notice. Co-main, Arnold Allen and his dad taking on Sadiq Youssef. Really looking forward to the entire card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Women's strawweight has been the premier division in the UFC as far as the women's divisions are concerned. And we have two of the top fighters in Nina Ansarov looking to make her return from motherhood? I guess taking on, well, fellow mother, Mackenzie Dern. And for Mackenzie Dern, since she took the time off, since loss to Amanda Ribas, four big wins. And she had a very busy 2020 for Nina Ansarov. The last time we saw her in a cage, it was a loss to Tatiana Suarez back a year and 9 months ago. And it was also the last time that we saw Tatiana Suarez as well. And for Ansarov, she had one of those Jan Blachowicz-type starts to her UFC career. She lost twice. She won some. I think she lost one in the middle. She went on a tidy little win streak. And you go all the way back to five on in. Actually, it was four. Jocelyn Jones-Liebarger, she gets a finish there. She beats Angela Hill, outstrikes Angela Hill. She beat Randa Markos, and she beat Claudia Gadelha. And she beat her, like, soundly. It was a really big win.
It was a great performance. And not to just cut you off from the Dahlia win, because it was really important, but that win really did set her up well for the Suarez fight, because there were a lot of similarities between the two. You look at what she did against Claudia. Claudia starts out really good. Her cardio is very suspect, but Claudia starts out great. Nina is a very composed fighter, and I think that's an important fact to bring out, because she's not a fighter who's going to waste any unintentional energy by being so tense up in the fight. I know it's a weird thing to talk about, but it is true. Nina Ansar is really good at outlasting grapplers, because a lot of people go in there. She's a tall, rangy striker. I know she fought Angela Hill, but the comp is there. They both fight in a very similar manner, so a lot of people go out there looking to take Nina Ansar off down. But Nina Ansar has great takedown defense, and then she just kind of forces that grappler to become a striker as the fight progresses. You even look at the Tatiana Suarez fight. Yeah, she lost. It, but I actually thought Nina Ansaroff looked really good in that loss. She gets taken down a lot in the first round, and the second round is a little bit more of the same, but you can tell with about a minute left in that second round, Nina Ansaroff's like, no, if I can keep the fight on the feet, it's going to be a completely different fight. And then you look at the complete third round, Nina Ansaroff tees off on Tatiana Suarez, completely exposes her striking, and really showed that, yeah, she might have not had the wrestling at one point in her career, but as the fight progresses, the cardio of Nina Ansaroff is so good that she will eventually be able to deny the takedown attempts of an Olympic-caliber wrestler in Tatiana Suarez. So for Nina Ansaroff, she's had fights that oddly do set her up for this one very well, and I think the Claudia Gadelha fight is a really important one to bring up, because Mackenzie Dern, to me, is just Claudia 3.0, if you will. She might have skipped the 2.0, because I really do think she's the more modern version of what Claudia used to be. She just has the cardio now, because for Claudia, for the longest time, and you can even go through every division and think of this, every division has that one submission threat. Heavyweight had Verdum forever, middleweight had Luke Rockhold, Damian Maia, welterweight's had Maia. Just every division has that one, like, BJJ specialist that you can't go to the mat with. Mackenzie Dern is now that fighter at women's strawweight, and it used to always be Claudia for me, because Claudia would come out. She had that great win over Karolina Kovalkiewicz. That doesn't look great over time, but still, she was that fighter you couldn't mess with on the mat. With Mackenzie Dern, she can be that fighter, but she does everything Claudia does. She just doesn't get tired as the fight progresses. The only problem I do have with Mackenzie Dern is I don't want her to get too hand-happy or too strike-happy now that she is with Jason Perillo. And you do look at the improvements that her striking has made. She looks far better than she did when she first came into the UFC. When Mackenzie Dern first came into the UFC, she just threw punches from her hips. And if they landed, that was great. But if they didn't, she was kind of screwed. Now she actually has decent technique behind her striking. She has decent power, too, for the division. And there's a lot to like about Mackenzie Dern. The only problem I have is that Mackenzie Dern has never fought a fighter like Nina Ansaroff. She's never fought a fighter. I guess you could bring up Ashley Yoder if you want to, but I don't think Yoder has the pop on the end of her shots that Ansaroff has. And I'm really worried about one thing for each fighter. A, how is this long layoff going to affect Nina Ansaroff? We even saw Mackenzie Dern in her first fight back after her pregnancy. She didn't look good against Amanda Hibas. And I'll be honest, maybe a bit of a hot take. A fully prepared Mackenzie Dern beats a fully prepared Amanda Hibas. Maybe I'm not right, but I do think that's a very competitive fight if they do end up running that back. I think that was a case of Dern came back a little bit too early after her layoff, whereas Ansaroff, it seems like she has given herself a little bit of time since her initial, or since her pregnancy, I guess, to really let her body settle in now and be the natural strawweight that she once was. So there's a lot of question marks coming from both sides. I think this is a really fun fight in the strawweight division.
For Mackenzie Dern, you look at that 3-fight win streak. So she does lose to Amanda Hibas. She beats Hannah Cyphers. That fight shouldn't have happened. She submits Randa Marcos. That doesn't happen every day.
She looked good.
And then she fought Vina Jandiroba, where her striking looked much improved. It was like Brian Ortega when he fought Korean Zombie, but she didn't put her out. And it was a kind of a close fight, and maybe some people thought Jandiroba won, but it doesn't really matter. Mackenzie Dern's got the W on her record and moves up the chain to fight Nina Ansaroff, who, again, coming off a long layoff, she has that loss to Tatiana Suarez, the uncrowned champ, so a lot of people like to think. But it makes for a very interesting one. For Mackenzie Dern, 5% on her takedowns given, if you want to call it that. That's 1 for 20. She does not need to get the takedown, because you can take her down. She's going to submit you. She doesn't need it to open things up. 0% takedown defense. She can just pull guard all day. And if you want to hop into it, you're going to get submitted 6 ways to Sunday. I look at this one. Yeah, it is kind of tricky, because if this fight happened before Ansaroff took the time off, if she lost to Suarez and then fought Dern, she would have mopped the floor with Mackenzie Dern. The advancements in the striking, I like them from Dern, but it is a tricky one.
It is. And That's the problem. I think everything says that Mackenzie Dern should win this fight. It really does. You have Anna Saraf, she's coming off a long layoff. Who really knows how invested she even has to be in her career anymore? Her wife is the greatest fighter of all time, and it's not even debatable anymore. So for Anna Saraf, you still really know where her priorities are, I guess. And if she is that fighter who still wants to, okay, I'm ready to lose a fight, lose another fight, and then work my way up the ranks again.
People said that about Nunes before she fought Megan Anderson.
And no one thought she was going to lose that fight, Craig. Why even bring that up?
Ansarov opened to minus 150. She's now minus 132 favorite for Mackenzie Dern coming back. The underdog open plus 130. She's now at a plus 109. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, there's a lot of them. 1,166, 82% Dern, 67% by submission. The fans overwhelmingly in Dern's corner. The gamblers, they have Nina Ansarov to get the win. It is a tricky one. I'd sit this one out, but I have a hard time with it.
I'm going to say Mackenzie Dern, but I can very openly admit that if she loses this fight, she's going to lose it in an ugly way. Because if Dern can't get the takedown or can't at least convince Ansarov to take her down or pull guard in some aspect, I do see Ansarov just kind of dancing around the cage, using a lot of her probing attacks to sort of break down Mackenzie Dern as the fight progresses. It has been a little while that Dern's been at Ruka, so maybe her striking has taken another step up, and maybe she can make it competitive on the feet with Ansarov, especially if she can close the distance, make it less of a kickboxing fight, more of a boxing fight. I do like Dern, but if Ansarov can keep the distance, use a lot of her kicks, it will be a good fight for Dern.
If we haven't lost a step with Nina Ansarov, she should be able to win this fight. I mean, good takedown defense, decent jiu-jitsu, and the much better striker, and she throws a lot of different looks as well. So for Nina Ansarov, I definitely see the path there. I'm going to side with the odds in this one. I've got Nina Ansarov.
Yeah, I've got Mackenzie Dern overwhelmingly. I just think, with that time off and with the improvements of Dern striking, I do think it's going to be a really hard time for Nina Ansarov in this fight.
Matt, really looking forward to this fight. I'm going Ansarov. You're going Dern. Should be a great card. 15 fights total, headline by Marvin Vettori and Kevin Holland. Let's keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say, Matt.
Let's get into it.
Hopped up the plane at LAX with a dream in my card again, saying, who's that guy with MC shaved into his chest hair, maybe? We've got the Cuban Missile Crisis, Julian Marquez, who shot a shot with Miley Cyrus, and that went up in a ball of flames. He's now taking on the firecrotch himself, Smiling Sam Alvey, big-time fight, Matt, at middleweight. And for Sam Alvey, this is his first fight at middleweight in 3.5 years. The last time out, it was a loss to Ramazan Ameev. And if you look at his 5-on-in, well, there's 4 losses and a draw, but not all losses are created equal. So let's go through those to start this off. He gets finished by Little Nog. That's a bad look, 2.5 years.
That's an awful look.
He gets finished by Jimmy Crute. Well, that's going to happen. He loses the decision to Clitson Abreu. Okay. Then he loses to Ryan Spann. It was a split decision. I had a 29-28 Alvey. Spann looked awful in that fight.
You have every split decision for the guy who lost, so that's fine.
Go back and check it on Twitter from the time that it happened. And then he had a draw against Dong Jung. And listen, Alvey more than likely won the first 2 rounds. Jung won the last round. And again, we talked about this in the Dong Jung breakdown for his fight this weekend. But it was something like 17 had it for Alvey, 2 had it a draw, and 1 had it for Dong Jung. So for Sam Alvey, his last 2 fights, very close to being wins. For Julian Marquez, he had so much time off between his last loss, where he took on Alessio Di Chirico, and his fight not that long ago against Maki Pitolo. Major back surgery, major injuries, wholesale changes to his camp, where he went from the notable Syndicate MMA. We've had a lot of Syndicate fighters on this card. He switched it up, went to Glory MMA and Fitness, and paid immediate dividends. The one thing that it didn't really, as far as fitness is concerned, Julian Marquez does not have the best cardio. It just so happened that he had slightly better cardio than Maki Pitolo on that night. But that was a slobber knocker of a fight if I've ever seen one.
I got bad news for you, Craig. This isn't going to be a great fight. I know we like to start these videos off by, oh, really excited for this one. This is one of the rare fights that I'm not overly excited for. Because with Sam Alvey, this is my problem. He's gotten so many opportunities from the UFC to actually make somewhat of a name for himself. They gave him Rashad Evans when he was on his last legs, and they fought to a split decision when Rashad Evans was barely even a fighter anymore. He barely threw a punch, and he was still almost able to beat Sam Alvey. This is my problem with Sam Alvey. I think he has decent power. I think he has okay submissions. I think he has some of the worst output in UFC history. I really do. I think Sam Alvey has an issue with A, being backed up to the cage, which I think Julian Marquez is going to be able to win this fight solely off cage control. And I hate that that's the thing I have to come to you guys with, that, oh, I think Marquez is going to win. But that's what Marquez does slightly better than Sam Alvey. Sam Alvey is more than happy to just give up double underhooks and have his back up against the cage. Now, I will admit that a lot of fighters who are able to do that to him are more primary grapplers than Julian Marquez. You look at guys like Clinton Abreu and others who are able, or do have more of a wrestling background, I should say, than Marquez. But they are able to get those double underhooks all the time on Sam Alvey. I'm not sure if it's just a position he struggles with in the gym, maybe. But it is something he gives up a lot in his fights. And even go back to the Little Nog fight. You kind of glossed over it. Only mention that one quick.
Little Nog knocked him out.
Little Nog doesn't fight anymore. He was 38 going into that fight. The fact that Little Nog was able to stop Sam Alvey, it's given me a lot of pause for Sam Alvey, who's now cutting an additional 20 pounds, who is already starting to look maybe a little bit shinny at 205. Now you're going to get rid of another 20 pounds of water from your body, which isn't going to help your durability at all. I'm not saying Julian Marquez is this dangerous striker, but all the signs are starting to point in Marquez's favor.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's a tricky fight for anybody to take in Julian Marquez, unless you have A-plus cardio. That's the way to beat Julian Marquez. If you have decent takedown defense, you might be able to beat Julian Marquez. For Sam Alvey, he has pretty good takedown defense, but that's it. For Julian Marquez, he's the type of guy that strikes into the clinch, that takes you down, that wears on you. And those are usually the fights that Sam Alvey loses. So I look at this one, Matt. Julian Marquez in this fight, he is the favorite. I was initially kind of scared off it again because I didn't think Marquez looked spectacular against Pitolo. Pitolo had his moments. He was out striking Marquez. Marquez took so much time off, and his cardio is such a question. So for me, I hold it off my card. But Marquez, open minus 125, is now minus 194. So quite a bit of money coming in on Marquez. Alvey open plus 105. He's now plus 159. Over on Tapology, 1,122 total votes. 86% Marquez, 69% by knockout. A lot of people are going with Julian Marquez to get the win. And hey, with James Krause in your corner, anything's possible.
I'm going to predict he wins. But no, Sam Alvey, I think this is it for him. Normally when you see a guy who's at the later stage of his career, now he's making a weight difference. I always panic when people change their weight. And I guess I'm going to go on a bit of a tangent. But you either switch weights for one of two reasons. Either A, you feel like physically you just can't match whatever guys you're fighting with in your weight class, so you decide to move down in weight. Or you're not fighting that well at your weight class for whatever reason, you're just not doing well, and you decide to make the change just for some drastic reason. For Sam Alvey, I've seen you at 185. You're the same fighter that you are at 205. I just think it's a bit of a weird move for him at this stage in his career, and he's the oldest 34-year-old of all time. I know their ages aren't that off, but the amount of years, and I guess just really MMA wear and tear that Sam Alvey has had compared to Julian Marquez, it really isn't even comparable, so I do like Marquez in this
fight. We'll see if Sam Alvey sports a top-to-bottom mouth guard, because at one point he broke his jaw straight in the middle. I go Sisu on this one. So Matt, for the overall pick, we're both going with Julian Marquez to get the win. I'm really looking forward to this fight. You can still hear me with that, but it should be a good one. I mean, listen, we have a great main event that happens to be at middleweight between Kevin Holland, who's coming back after 2 weeks and an absolute drubbing against Derek Brunson, taking on Marvin Vettori. Should be a great one. Really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time middleweight fight, Matt, between UFC debutant Ali Askab Kazriev and Kyle Daukaus. And Matt, I love this fight. I mean, Ali Askab Kazriev, a guy that's been on a lot of people's radars for really the longest time. I mean, he beat Paul Harris, you know, who's smart Paul Harris, back in 2018. You want to see a good fight. You want to see a guy get killed. Husamar Paharis goes over there to Russia, thinks, hey, I'm juicy AF. I'm going to beat this guy. Gets hit clean, gets dropped. Now, did he pull guard? Maybe he did, but he got finished. And listen, could Ali Askab Kazriev go out there and have a career like Emil Mech? Maybe he does. However, when I watch this guy fight, it gets me up in the morning, if I'm telling you, and if I'm being totally honest. Like, this is the type of Sunday morning stuff that I get up about. And for Ali Askab Kazriev, you look at it. He'll throw a high kick with his lead leg. He'll throw a high kick with his back leg. Really long-rangey southpaw. He throws kicks to the body. He works very fast. There's so many fights that you can go back and watch. The Matei Trujan fight is the one that I like from Fight Nights Global 62, where he throws a kick. You see Trujan just kind of drop his hand down. And then Kazriev goes, I don't care about your hand that's down. I'm going to throw a punch there. Drops him. And then soccer kicks him for good effect. After that, beats Yasube Inamoto by decision. I like that. The 3-round experience. Beats Usmar Paul Harris. Then takes over 2 years off. He takes 2.5 years off. He fights Enrique Shigemoto over on Contender Series, and it's just more of the same. The guy just goes absolutely total explosiveness. It worries me against a lot of fighters. It worries me in this fight against Kyle Daukaus. But the guy is super explosive, super athletic. He's a guy coming out of Eagles MMA. You're going to see a lot of comparisons, a lot of people that you've seen before in his corner. Maybe the Sultan Aliyevs. We've seen Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov before, and so on and so forth. Now, coming into this one, listen, I've seen different pictures on the Instagrams at American Top Team. I put that over as his gym right now coming in. But in the higher weight classes, there's still some pretty good fighters there. Now, I will say, and Kyle Daukaus talked about it. It was a talking point on our recent episode of This Week in MMA with Fight Night Picks because, of course, the interview is on the channel. But Kyle Daukaus talked about the fact that he's fought smaller opponents before. He doesn't change his game plan to strike with smaller guys. And Kyle Daukaus, one of the bigger middleweights you're going to find. It's 6'3 with a really long reach. He's got a couple of inches. Kazariev, for a short guy, has pretty good reach. So I love the fight because for Kyle Daukaus, if you weren't high on him coming into the UFC, that's fine. But he had a good fight against Brandon Allen. It just so happened that he lost in his debut and he looked really good against Dustin Stutzfus that had a very well-rounded background coming into the UFC his last time out.
I'm as excited for this fight as I am for any other fight on the card. I really am because for Kyle Daukaus and for Kazariev, there we go. It's going to be interesting because I do think both guys have very high ceilings in this division. It's kind of a shame that they're being matched up this early on because, like I mentioned, Kyle Daukaus, he has the range, but his grappling is on another level. Just go back to the Brendan Allen fight. Yes, he loses that fight, but there's sometimes where you can lose and you still gain stock. And I really do think that was one of those performances because he basically gets 10-8 in the first round, gets dominated in the second round, and comes back to have almost a 10-8 in the third round. If you're able to withstand that kind of punishment from a guy like Brendan Allen, who I'm not going to completely compared to Kazariev, but they both have similar styles where when they do get you to the ground, they don't waste any time trying to damage you. They will jump guard just to try to get into mount, just so they can try to make you absorb damage as the fight progresses. And for Daukaus, we've seen him in there with, I don't want to say complete mirrors of Kazariev, just because it's not like Brendan Allen's the striker that Kazariev, and he doesn't throw many kicks either, but we have seen him with other heavy grappling fighters, and he has fared quite well against them.
The Jonovan Webb fight that he had, I mean, that was a UFC vet. You look at Daukaus, he was early on in his career. He finished him right at the very end of that fight, CFFC 72. Like, he has some pretty good experience coming up through.
And it does seem to be one of those kind of best of both worlds, because a lot of Kazariev's finishes come really early on in the fight. And then you look at Daukaus, his finishes do tend to come in that second and third round. So I don't want to say this is easy as, oh, after that, you know, 2 minutes, 50 seconds point in that second round, will it automatically become Daukaus' fight? No, but it will be really interesting to see how much the size of Daukaus does come into play to the grappling of Kazariev. Because if Daukaus is able to get on top, I know I mentioned this a lot in our videos before, but he's the much bigger fighter in this fight. And if Daukaus is able to get that top position, I swear for even 2 minutes, the amount of exhaustion that Kazariev will feel on the bottom just trying to escape, it's going to cause him a lot of panic, A, which will really gas him out. But also, you're going to be working so much harder to get that bigger guy off of you. Now, can he do sweeps off the bottom? Yes, he can. Both very good grapplers. It just will be interesting to see how much the size of Daukaus will play into effect. But you can also look at this as the other way. I do think Kazariev is the faster of the two. And if he is very dedicated to his kicking game and staying on the outside, you mentioned the body kicks. If he's just dedicated to the leg kick from the outside, take away some of that range and some of the footwork of Daukaus and force him to become a striker. Because we all know how good the grappling of Kyle Daukaus is. It's not like he's a poor striker by any means. But if this fight is completely contested on the feet, I like Kazariev quite a bit.
Kazariev. Wow. Like, again, you want to go back and have a fun trip through the highlight reels. And not highlight reels. You watch the full fights, but they're only, you know, 2.5 minutes, 30 seconds. It pretty much is a highlight reel. It's a lot of fun. 5 wins by knockout, 3 by submission, 5 by decision for Kazariev. And if we look at Kyle Daukaus representing Martinez BJJ, 2 by decision, 8 by submission. I talked about that Jonovan Webb fight. And really, if you look at it, he just kind of went through his lumps as an amateur. 5-5 overall, he got finished. That's going to happen. You like to see that out of somebody exactly. That at least puts it in as far as an amateur career is concerned. The big win over Steven Regman, the big win over Nolan Norwood. And again, he was a champ with CFFC. You like to see that as well. I mean, Pat Sabatini headlined that card back in February. Pat Sabatini had a fight announced today in a big fight, and really looking forward to seeing him. For Kazidiev, had a fight booked already this spring. It fell through against Wellington Turman. Turman out of that one. But for Kazidiev, again, we've seen him in the States. He's been at ATT, so on and so forth. So if we have a look at the odds for this one, Matt, were you at all surprised where they opened? Because for Aliaskab Kazidiev, he opened a minus 235 favorite. He's a minus 126. And for Kyle Daukaus, opened at plus 200. He's now at a plus 100. He is the biggest mover and shaker on this card. 49%, 50% clip.
I am really surprised, I'll be honest. And I do think this is one of those cases of they didn't set them right. And I do think the odds have kind of settled to where they should be. I understand that Kislyev is a slight favorite over Daukaus because, again, you look at what he's able to get done on the feet in addition to his grappling, whereas Daukaus, he does, like I said, I don't think Daukaus...
Straight to clinch, to take him down, to submit him.
Exactly. Daukaus knows what he's good at, but you can see how he gets to his submissions. He is very much, I'm going to strike my way into the clinch, walk forward. He will eat some unnecessary shots by doing that. And when he does fight the upper echelon, let's say he ever fights Robert Whittaker, that's not going to be the play, and hopefully he switches up his plan. But against these unranked guys, you might be able to get away with that. I'm actually going to pick Kislyev in this fight for this sole purpose. I think speed kills, and I think he's the much faster fighter of these two. And I do like him at range. And if he is dedicated to the kicks enough, here's the thing. When guys kick, they really only kick in the first round and a half, and then people will stop kicking just because it takes so much more energy to kick than it does to punch. If Kislyev can be dedicated to the kicks in that first round, I do think he can damage some of the mobility of Daukaus to the point where Daukaus' cardio won't be as much of a factor in that second and third round. I can openly admit that if this fight goes into the third round, I like Daukaus quite a bit, but I don't know if it gets there.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. I mean, with Daukaus, he has the cardio. He has the... longevity is one of those guys we talk about it. Listen, are you the Walmart brand battery or are you the Duracell? Can you keep it there the whole time? More a lithium thing than anything. But for Kyle Daukaus, he has that. Is his striking insane? Is it even as good as Chris's? Well, no, it's not Chris nearly as good as Chris. But for Aliaskab Kazyev, we've seen it where he can strike, but he's super explosive. And the things that Kazyev does well, if he's going to throw you, if he's going to suplex you, if he's going to look for these massive submissions, he expends a ton of energy to do it. It plays into the hands of Daukaus. Over on Tapology, 1,094 total votes. 72% Kazyev, 66% by decision. Surprised there's more people that don't think that he's going to be able to get a finish. I'm surprised. I'm really looking forward to this one. I have the Black Wolf, Aliaskab Kazyev, to get the win. Kazyev, there we go. It's a difficult one. It will come with time, but we're both going with Aliaskab Kazyev to get the win. It should be a great one. Check out Kyle's interview. It's an awesome one. And maybe we get to eat some humble pie after perhaps this one. I'd like to know what people are thinking out there in the comments section as far as your picks for this fight, because it has to be a decisive one. I see this like 50-50 going in the comments. Really looking forward to what people are thinking here. But overall, a great card. 15 fights. We still have Alan Youssef. You also have the man himself, Marvin Vettori, taking on short notice opponent in our 2020 Fight Night Picks Fighter of the Year, Kevin Holland. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Gut Bush? You definitely do if you haven't tried the best products from our sponsor today. It's, of course, Manscaped. After using these life-changing products, listen, you're going to want to join a ball sack beauty contest. I'm looking out for you, too, because I also have an exclusive 20% off discount code. Use the code FNP at manscaped.com. Matt, we've all been there before. Listen, you're a shower shaver, and I talk about it week in and week out. And I still am. I haven't changed my plan. I haven't just started shaving in the backyard, shaving in the sink.
I'm sure your neighbors appreciate it.
Still a shower guy. And for me, it's Lawnmower 3.0. The LED light that's there, you can hear it. That's great stuff. And the big bonus is the light. I mean, listen, it's got a ceramic blade. You're not going to nick your nuts, this and that. But if I can actually see what I'm doing, I'm going to end up with less problems. And we've all been there. I bought that cheap kind of set that you can buy at the big box store, and it gets rusty, it gets gross, you forget to oil it. Like, there's a lot of issues that can arise, and I don't want tetanus. So, yeah, I've been there before with the cheap stuff. This is waterproof. You can use it in the shower. It's not a big deal. They're dedicated to helping you level up your full body grooming game with the perfect package 3.0. And if you go with it, you get the shit. And who doesn't need a nice toiletry bag? Listen.
It's nice.
The world's going to eventually open up. And I am the type that really likes to have a nice toiletry bag. The other thing, this used to be a talking point for these folks, but the charging stand. And listen, we're still doing Zoom stuff. You're still on Skype. You're still on Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, I don't know, whatever Aleister Overeem used to use. And listen, you're parading yourself around your house. If you've got that on your bathroom, I don't know, if you got it hanging out.
Your fireplace even.
Your fireplace. It's a good look. A nice charging stand can make a big difference. It's definitely the best trimmer that you can get to help trim and groom the hedges. And it also features, like I said, a cutting-edge ceramic blade to help reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin-safe technology, which was pioneered by Manscaped. When you trim the hedges, the tree stands taller. If you're a grower, not a shower, that's very important.
If you want rusty nuts, go ahead, click away. That's fine with us. You don't have to. But if you want the best male grooming tool out there, try Manscaped out.
Matt, they also have in the perfect package the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. I tell you every week, slap that stuff on there. It works great. They also have the Crop Reviver. Now, this is starting to get a little bit less.
Might need
a little bit more, but it's a nice little spritz. I won't spritz it out there today, but you just toss that stuff on your nuts. It's good stuff as well. They also have the Weed Whacker in the package. You see me do this every week, but I'll trim my nose here on camera.
How fast does it grow?
It grows pretty fast. It's always grown pretty fast. And if you do get the perfect package, it also comes with the Shed Travel Bag as well as the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped boxers. And if you head over to their website as well, they also have the greatest refined cologne. It's that great Manscaped scent. It's good stuff there, too. So get 20% off and free shipping using the code FNP at manscaped.com. Do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for your bush trimming experience. Matt, let's keep it going with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight in our co-main event. We have featherweight's almighty Arnold Allen taking on Super Sadiq Youssef. And Matt, if we had a rank 'em of all-time MMA dads, and I give you four of them, we're going to go with Amanda Hibas's dad that had that crazy tattoo of Emily Whitmire getting submitted by, Amanda Hibas. Lance Palmer's dad with the Ultimate Farting Championship t-shirt. We also have Chris Weidman's dad still his son.
The obvious
one. And then you also have Arnold Allen's dad. You know, the bodybuilder. Oh. Rank him? I mean, Arnold Allen's dad's right up there with the rest of them. Now, as far as his fighting style, this is a guy that I think he unfortunately gets lumped into the same category as Nathaniel Wood. Now, for Nathaniel, his nickname is The Prospect, so he's forever The Prospect. But both guys, English, they're in the lower weight classes. And they've really had a slow burn to get to the top. It's been a while since Arnold Allen's been in the UFC. And you probably think of him as, that young, fresh-faced guy with a stupid mustache. Yeah, you'd be 100% right. The young guy that had his UFC debut back in 2015 against Alan Omer. Yeah, that's him. That's Arnold Allen. And so far in the UFC, his only finish, and it just keeps looking better, against Mads Burnell, who had great success in Cage Warriors, and I think he's going to light it up with Bellator. But that win keeps looking better. If you want to go with the five on in, you got the Burnell at the fourth spot. You got Makwan Amerikani by split. You got Jordan Rinaldi, no longer in the UFC, but a very good grappler. You've got Gilbert Melendez and Nick Lentz. To me, two statement wins the last two. Melendez, to me, is the top one. You look at the fights that he's been matched up in as well. He had the Josh Emmett booking that fell out. Emmett, wasn't able to make it. So Nick Lentz stepped in and got the break speed off him. And then Arnold Allen was supposed to fight Jeremy Stevens back in November. Stevens out due to injury. So Arnold Allen coming in here against Sadiq Youssef. And I have to say this before I hand it over. Sadiq Youssef had a massive fight booked against Edson Barboza back in October. That one fell out. Youssef was out. And now we're here. And he gets Arnold Allen. So two guys that still in the prospect stage, even though they're late in the game. For Youssef, comes into the UFC, beats Suman Mokhtarian, beats Shimon Moraes, beats Gabriel Benitez, and Andre Feely. A lot of really good wins for Youssef. It's been a while since we've seen him, just over a year, too.
Sadiq Youssef has just the classic kind of progression of an MMA fighter. You're fighting guys you should beat, you're beating them, you suffer a loss, you retool, and then you come back. And you just have to look at kind of the run that he's gone on since then. Knockout in 39 seconds. He beat Mike Davis on Contender Series, and Mike Davis is just coming off a win against Mason Jones, former Cage Warriors champ. So that tells you the type of fighter who we're dealing with in Sadiq Youssef. He was up a weight class against a very good 155-pounder, and he was still able to beat him. Now, I gotta be honest. When Arnold Allen
was one at featherweight.
Oh, sorry. I thought that one was the lightweight. Arnold Allen versus Josh Emmett would have been a great fight, but in my mind, the most exciting fight that could have gotten made at 145, and hopefully we'll see it in the future, I need Sadiq Youssef to fight Josh Emmett at some point in the future. I think that fight ends in knockout, probably the first 4 minutes. I have no idea who wins. Just a side note. I like a lot of what Sadiq Youssef does. And then you look at his win over Mokhtarian. Of course, he knocked him out. That fight wasn't competitive at all. He beats the brakes off Shaymon Moraes, who is a fighter who I think we liked him a lot more than most other people did. And then you go to the Benitez fight.
Because he looked like Jeremy Meeks.
He did. He was a handsome cat. He just didn't beat a lot of good guys in the UFC. In the Benitez fight, it was, oh, Youssef's going to win. Youssef's going to win. A lot of people thought he was going to win. I was one of the few who picked Benitez. And it was a good example of a fight where a fighter gets tested, but they still end up winning. Youssef gets dropped with a quick shot in the start of the first round. He's able to come back, basically just marches Benitez down, knocks him out at the end of the first round. Then the Andre Feely fight. We see some wrestling out of Youssef. We see some defensive wrestling. We see him work off his back. We see a lot of different wrinkles that we haven't seen before, and I just like how as Sadiq Youssef has fought in tougher competition, he's had to show slightly different just aspects of his MMA game. Whereas Arnold Allen, you bring up his top wins. Yeah, beating Gilbert Melendez is nice. Yeah, beating Nick Lentz is nice, but it's been a while since we've really seen Arnold Allen in there with someone who is supposed to beat Arnold Allen. I know that's a weird way of saying it, but it's not like anyone thought he was going to lose to Melendez. He was a massive favorite in that fight. Melendez fighting at 145, never should have in the first place, because we all know him for being that great 155-pound champ. Then you fight Nick Lentz. Nick Lentz is now retired, and that's not the same Nick Lentz who was fighting, you know, circa 2014 to 16, let's say. For Allen, I understand why he is ranked. He's on this great win streak. My problem is there's not a single name on that win streak that really jumps out to me. Mads Burnell, yeah, that's a good win. But even Mads Burnell, I wouldn't say that's a better win than the Benitez or the Feely win are on Youssef's record. In my mind, at least, I have Youssef as that top level prospect. I really do. He's in that, I guess, former Macy Barber category, but he's in those prospects though who you look at and you're like, okay, I can really see him fighting for a title one day. Arnold Allen's good. He's very well rounded. He has great cardio, and again, he is just good at everything. I don't know what he's gonna do that's gonna stop the forward pressure of Sadiq Youssef, because what Youssef's really great at, I can throw low calf kicks, overhands. I've got more power than anyone in the division. What does Arnold Allen do to stop the forward momentum of Sadiq Youssef? And I don't really know what the answer is.
The thing that I'm most looking forward to in this fight is the kicks, because Arnold Allen throws great kicks. You saw that in the Lentz fight, but really it was accentuated in that Gilbert Melendez fight. He just kept going to the well.
The competition, though.
And he looked good. And I mean, listen, you're really kind of downplaying Arnold Allen. That's fine.
It's just, if any other guy in the top 15's last two wins were Gilbert Melendez and Nick Lentz, people wouldn't want them ranked. That's my only point.
I mean, listen, Ally Quinta's still ranked at lightweight.
He beat Kevin Lee in a 5-round main event. That at least gets you into the rankings. My problem is Arnold Allen never had that statement win that's, okay, now you deserve to be in the rankings. Sadiq Youssef knocked out Gabriel Benitez, who, yeah, I know I'm his biggest fan in the world, but that still means something to me. And he beat Andre Feely, who's just good at everything and does a lot similar to Arnold Allen.
All right, so we look at this fight. Again, you've got Allen, the southpaw, the orthodox fighter, and Sadiq Youssef. As far as corners are concerned, I mean, Arnold Allen coming out of BKK Fighters over in England. We know everything there is to know about his dad. That lifts stuff in the front yard. He's like a tough Luke Thomas that could fight maybe
like
in a
Zach
bar.
Grisha?
And then you look at Sadiq Youssef, a guy that trains out of Lloyd Irvin Martial Arts. Not really known for the fighters so much. Like, I mean, you've got Tafan Chukwe, you've got Sadiq Youssef. There's a few others that train there, but it's not really
Sadiq
the most
Youssef's pretty good, though.
Well-known gym. I mean, you had James Vick for a while. Things haven't worked out well at Lloyd Irvin. So you got a fight here, Matt, where Sadiq Youssef comes in and he's the favorite. And it's not much of a surprise to most people. Now, opening odds had Youssef at a minus 120. It dropped really quick. He was a minus 180. He's now minus 139. The line's starting to drop on him again. For Arnold Allen, he's coming in here. He opened a plus 100. He's plus 114. And if we go over to Tapology, 1,125 total votes, Matt. 60% going Allen, 88% by decision. The 40% that I've Youssef, 61% by decision, 32% by knockout. Sadiq Youssef, can the gas tank hold up in a fight against Arnold Allen that's just go, 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 go?
I think it can for this reason alone. When Youssef lands, he damages, and that just is the case. When he lands punches on his opponents, they feel it, and they are different because of those shots that he lands. Arnold Allen has good volume, but my issue is, and we talk about this sometimes with fighters who throw in combination, how, and I'll say Robert Whittaker because it's just a good example, where Robert Whittaker throws combinations, but he can choose which punches are going to be the really heavy ones he's going to put everything into, whereas Allen, it's just a lot of volume. It's a lot of volume. He never really has those really snapping shots at the end of it, and for Allen, Allen, unless he does go for the takedown early and often against Yusuf, really make Yusuf work hard in that first round so that maybe cardio will become a factor. I just don't see it. I see Yusuf being the one who's going to connect with Allen as Allen tries to enter in and get inside of range. And you just see Yusuf continuing to hit him every time he tries to come close. For Allen, it is really that I'm going to try to clinch into my strike and go for the takedown, because I don't think even Arnold Allen's coaches are telling him, hey, go out there and strike at range with Sadiq Yusuf for 15 minutes. They'd be insane if they told him to do that. For him, he has to make this an MMA fight. He has to mix in the wrestling. He has to mix in some of the kicks and really just make this, again, about all facets of MMA, not just a boxing fight.
Gotta make it an MMA fight. And again, I mean, Yusuf slowed down a little bit in the third round against Andre Feely, but the number that I really like to look at, if you want to look at stats that jump off the page, strikes landed per minute, Yusuf less so in terms of the experience. You got the one contender series fight in the UFC fights, but 6.1 significant strikes landed per minute to Arnold Allen's 3.19. But then you look at the number of strikes absorbed per minute for Yusuf, 4.06. Allen isn't even reaching that number. It's really tough to try and average those out to where Arnold Allen has to land more than 4.06 to really start to make a big difference. Now, could he do it with the kicks? 100% he can. I mean, Sadiq Yusuf has big legs. He's a short guy, but that's the thing. He does a really good job of checking kicks. So same wavelength. I get Yusuf in this fight. I mean, again, I see that he's the favorite, but the fans have Arnold Allen. Yeah, I've got Super Sadiq in this one. I mean, I see him pushing a pace on Arnold Allen, Allen getting backed up. And the other thing, Arnold Allen hasn't fought that much. He started in the UFC in 2015. He's 7-0 in that time frame. Yusuf's been the much more active fighter. Now, I get it. Yusuf hasn't fought since that one against Andre Feely back early last year. But I'm still all about the Super Sadiq. I think the big prospect's going to get the win here. And he might even take the number away.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. This is a really important fight for the featherweight division, because one of these two guys are going to start fighting those marquee names that we know and love at 145. So I think this is a very important fight for the division, but I agree with you. I guess Sadiq
wouldn't be a co-main event slot if it wasn't. True. Really. But both of us going with Super Sadiq Yusuf to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. And up next, our main event preview for Marvin Vettori and his short-notice opponents in replacing Darren Till. It's Kevin Holland. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Big-time main event coming up this weekend. We have Marvin Vettori, the Italian Dream, taking on the Trailblazer, Kevin Holland. As always, one half your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at CraigAllenFNP. Matt Allen, you can find him at Matt Allen FNP on the respective socials. And we're really looking forward to Question Mark Kicks coming up this Saturday, where we get the final opportunity to preview the fights. We get to make our final predictions. Maybe somebody had a tough weight cut. Maybe some of these fights fell out. We get a final opportunity to talk about them. There's also great interviews on the channel for this week. We've got Kyle Daukaus. We've got Joe Selecki. We've got Sasha Palatnikov. Some really good ones out there. Make sure you check those out. But in our main event, well, we were getting ready for Darren Till. It was supposed to be the Scouser, and he was going to be taking on Marvin Vettori in a really interesting clash of styles. Till mostly known as a striker, Vettori very well-rounded. And now, with Darren Till out due to collarbone issues, you have Kevin Holland. And it's so weird how Kevin Holland's life has changed in the last 2 weeks to where he was our 2020 Fight Night Picks Male Fighter of the Year. And he had that distinction with a lot of different shows and a lot of different people. His 2020 was insane. He won 5 fights. He was finishing people. He finished Jacare Souza, knocked him out. He finished Charlie Ontiveros, not Charlie Olives, but Charlie Ontiveros. Yeah. Unless he has a right hand like Butterbean, I don't know how the hell he's going to beat poor Marvin Vettori. And it's such a weird fight, because for Vettori, listen, we saw these two guys be in a spot where a lot of people, yourself included, and I'm not trying to make fun of you and single you out, but a lot of people thought Holland was supposed to fight Vettori back in the fall, but it wasn't so. Holland was supposed to fight the man himself, Jack Hermanson. Vettori was supposed to fight Jacare Souza. There was COVID on Holland's side. Things got mixed around. Holland gets Jacare, knocks him out. Vettori put on probably the most impressive performance of his career, unless you count Venator fights, where he beat Jack Hermanson and beat him handily in that one too.
He looked great in that fight, and I had Jack Hermanson winning that fight. Sorry, that makes it sound like I had him winning at the end of the fight. I thought going into that fight that the grappling of Jack Hermanson would be a little bit too much for Marvin Vettori, and unlike a lot of what Vettori did, I just thought it was too early for him. I was very wrong, though. And Marvin Vettori proved that he's actually a really good five-round fighter. And his style actually does pertain to a five-round atmosphere. And it's interesting because there's a lot of fighters who... Here's a good example. Zabit would probably be undefeated if every fight was only three rounds. But he's a guy who you can tell that fourth and fifth round will be a struggle once he gets to that area. With Vettori, we see him in that fourth and fifth round against a guy like Jack Hermanson, who's known for his really good cardio and really good output. Marvin Vettori looked great against him. And it's really important, too, when you go back to that fight. Not only was that nominated for Fight of the Year on the UFC's own website, which tells you how good of a fight it was a fight that showed every aspect of Marvin Vettori's game. He showed his takedowns himself against a very good grappler. He showed his takedown defense. And he showed, I'd say, uncharacteristic power. Because for Marvin Vettori, I don't want to liken him to a Brad Tavares, but I thought they were very much a similar fighter going into that fight. I thought they had good power, but not great power, to where if they clip you clean and you have your hands down, they can put you down. But unless you are in one of those crazy brawls, their power doesn't really stay. Marvin Vettori just kept on landing straight lefts over and over and over, and eventually Jack Hermanson did fall down due to them. Now, Hermanson showed great heart, got back to his feet, and did have one of the better fights of last year, but I was just really happy to see that Marvin Vettori showed every aspect of his game, and it's something that we talk about probably too much, where you learn a lot more about a fighter if they win a hard three-round decision than if they just go out there and beat their opponent 10 seconds by knockout.
Like Ali Askab Kriziev in his fight, or Kizriev, who's taking on Kyle Daukaus.
Exactly. You don't learn as much if they're just going out there starching people in 15 seconds. But if they do have a few fights in the record that do go longer, you can learn a lot more. Well, with Marvin Vettori, in the most pressure he's ever faced, in the longest fight he's ever been in, he looked his best. And I really do think Marvin Vettori knows how close he is to Israel Adesanya skill-wise. I do think he knows that. I think he took so much from losing to Adesanya in their first fight. And I know people like to hate on Vettori because he goes around like he won that first fight. And that's fine. In his mind, maybe he did. But I think he took a lot of confidence from narrowly losing to one of the better fighters we have on the planet. And I do think that ever since that fight, there's been a different Marvin Vettori. He knows how close he can be to that championship level fighters, and he's starting to train like that now. And if you do look at the fighters he's gone out there and beats the brakes off Carlos Diego Fajeia, he beats Fajeia, then he beats our boy Andrew Sanchez in what was an odd fight, but still, Vettori looked really good. And then, of course, in his last two fights, the bad blood matchup against Karl Roberson. We love the striking of Karl Roberson. His ground game leaves a lot to be desired. But Marvin Vettori went out there and did what you'd expect him to do. Immediately takes him down, gets a head and arm choke, submits him. That's another thing about Marvin Vettori's game. Physically, I would say one of the stronger guys at 185. He does have that kind of, I'll say, Yoel Romero build, but it's true. Marvin Vettori is a very big guy for this weight class, and if he does start to get dedicated to his wrestling early on in fights against guys like Kevin Holland, even against guys like, let's throw in Kelvin Gastelum, I'll even throw Robert Whittaker in there. If he can get wrestling these guys really early, he's going to tire them down a lot just because of how big and physically strong Marvin Vettori is. But I'm going to bring it back to you on this question. You asked me, what can Kevin Holland do to meet Marvin Vettori? I think his only chance is landing a big strike at range and going for a submission shortly after. That's the only way I see Kevin Holland winning this fight.
You look at this for Holland, and I liken it to Tyron Woodley. Tyron Woodley lost three big fights against the highest level competition at welterweight. And what did he do in his last fight? He went for broke, and he had to. That was all he could do. And he did exactly that. And people commend him for it. They do.
Bad fighter to do it against.
Still lost the fight. But I expect Kevin Holland to almost do the same thing. You look at it. Let's go five on in, because you can't really go back too far. But Joaquin Buckley, he wins that fight. Buckley had opportunities, but Holland looked good, and he won it handily. Darren Stewart, that was a weird fight. It was a split. It was a close one. Stewart kind of rallied. He beat Charleon Taveras, that came up on short notice, up a weight class, hurt his neck. Like, that was a weird fight. Good win for Holland. You can't take anything away from him. And then Jacare, well, that was kind of crazy. The punch, and the punch, and the punch, and it was all over. The Brunson fight was 2 weeks ago. Now, we had an episode of Early Stoppage, which is a podcast with Fight Night Picks, myself and John Franklin.
Check it out.
We talked about it in retrospect, where for Kevin Holland, would it make sense for him to switch gyms? He's been with Travis Luter for a long time, who, listen, reached almost the top of the heap at middleweight, this weight class, fought Anderson Silva for the belt. He earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt under Travis Luter. But in his last fight, it was almost like the spotlights got to him. He was more focused on barking back and forth with Dana White and Khabib, and that was kind of it. And then in the third round, the fourth round, the fifth round, he's still not totally listening to his coach. And if I'm Travis Luter, it's all right. Hey, bud, I get that Big Mouth is kind of the moniker here. We're having fun with it. But you got to put up or shut up at one point, and he didn't. So it's really tough for me to see that performance 2 weeks ago. This guy was my 2020 fighter of the year. And 2 weeks ago, he put on a bad performance. He laid an egg. Did he crack Brunson a couple times? 100% he did. But Brunson totally out-wrestled him. When he was on top, Brunson wore on him, and he just hammered away, and he won that fight handily. 2 weeks after, you're going to take on a younger version of Derek Brunson and Marvin Vettori that's a southpaw with a piston of a left hand? I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Kevin Holland can definitely go out there and knock him out. I mean, for Marvin Vettori, though, he does have an added X factor of a former and current, I should say, training partner. Now, has he trained a little bit with Khalil Roundtree in the past? Yeah, you're going to work in some of your striking. You're going to work in some of the kick game from a guy like Roundtree that has since moved over to Tiger Muay Thai and Thailand. But for Vettori, he spent a lot of time with Sean Strickland. A long-rangey striker, a big guy for the weight class that does a lot of things that Holland can do. Is he as mobile? Not so much, but he's a very good striker. You've seen that pre and post motorcycle accident from Strickland. For Holland, it's just a tough ask. And I remember saying this before the Brunson fight. Now, Matt switched his pick on question mark kick to Brunson, and I had Holland.
I had mine originally as Brunson.
No, you didn't. We both had Holland. I know we did. We can check the tapes. But you switched it over to Brunson, and I kept it with Holland. But I know I said, look at that stat for takedown defense. It's incredibly porous. 51% takedown defense for Kevin Holland. It's not like that happens overnight. That happens throughout a career. For Kevin Holland, yeah. Is it weighted a little bit by his first fight in the UFC up a weight class on short notice to Thiago Santos? Sure it is. But he gets taken down by Will Santiago. Then Thiago Santos. He takes down John Phillips. Again, you want to give Jack Shore the comp, the Welsh wrestling, to. John Phillips wrestling sucks. Gets taken down six times by Mearshart, wins a split decision. Gets taken down by DiCirco. Taken down by Brendan Allen. Taken down by Darren Stewart. Taken down by Jacare Souza, albeit he knocked him out. Taken down six times by Derek Brunson in a five-round fight. Is he fight fresh? Is he still ready? For sure he is.
This is my issue, though. No one's talking about the amount of damage that Kevin Holland ate in that fight. And I understand he was the one who got dropped. It's not like he got dropped and then got dominated on the mat. He had a lot of heavy ground and pound strikes from Derek Brunson, though. And I do like what you brought up. We talked about the five on in and how he looks in his recent record. I don't care about any of Kevin Holland's recent fights except for his last one. And I don't often say that, but that last performance left such a sour taste in my mouth. Because even just look at the second round. Kevin Holland almost knocks out Derek Brunson. There's actually a positive to take from that round that if you talk to your coaches, they might be able to help you with that in the third, fourth, and fifth. You decided to completely ignore that to talk to Dana White and Khabib. And I understand maybe his head is in a different place, whatever the excuse is, but you got dominated pretty one-sided just 2 weeks ago. It's hard for me to think that a better fighter in Marvin Vettori isn't going to have similar success to what Derek Brunson was able to have against Kevin Holland. Do I think Marvin Vettori can get the takedown on Kevin Holland? I do. The one thing about Kevin Holland, and the reason that I'm not always as worried about his takedown defense, is we both know he is a very good black belt on the ground. My issue is when you fight guys like Marvin Vettori, they're going to be able to take you down and be good enough defensively to not get caught in an armbar in their guard. They are sound enough defensively to be really smart on the ground. And the fact that Vettori has gone out there and fought guys like Jack Hermanson, like Andrew Sanchez, really good grapplers. It's weird that Andrew Sanchez is actually getting a shout out for being a good fighter.
NAIA champion wrestler?
Exactly. But the fact that Vettori's gone out there and had very grappling heavy fights and has just had those really dirty fights. Go back to the Omari Akhmedov fight. Yeah, it was a draw, but it was just one of those really tiring fights from both guys. And you can tell that at the end of the fight, both guys are absolutely spent. I've seen Marvin Vettori get himself to absolute exhaustion and still be able to perform at a very high level in MMA. I've seen Kevin Holland face a little bit of adversity and just completely get knocked off his game plan. So for me, I'm picking Marvin Vettori overwhelmingly in this fight.
If you're Kevin Holland, again, game plan for Derek Brunson, what is it? Strike from the outside and hope he doesn't close distance?
Pretty much.
Probably has to be the same game plan against Marvin Vettori. And can Vettori get cracked? Yeah.
Got a chin, though.
Got a pretty good chin, though. So again, you look at striking differentials. Does Vettori absorb more than Holland does per fight? Yeah, he typically does. Again, Vettori, you have less of a sample size in the UFC because Holland just fought every other weekend last week. And that's the thing. It worked for him last year. So who's to say it won't work for him this year? It's going to be tough, though. He kicked off the win streak with Fluffy Hernandez. He ended it with Jacare Souza. That's an incredible progression. Jacare Souza is out of the rankings now, and he's fighting Andrea Muniz coming up to a screen near you. So can't wait to predict that one and break that one down. As far as the odds are concerned, Marvin Vettori opened a minus 230 favorite. He's now minus 325. And for Kevin Holland, he at this point is a +251 underdog, open a +188. So the line continues to drop on Marvin Vettori. And if we have a look at the total votes over on Tapology, listen, you got 924, 83% Vettori, and you have 56% by decision, a further 25% by submission. Listen, I get it. There's going to be people out there, and I want to hear from you. Who are you picking in this fight? Are you going Italian Dream, even though it should be Stallion? Because for me, I think of it, and it's like, you make me feel like I'm living a Ryan Parrish dream. Like, I don't know many Italian singers. And for Kevin Holland, Trailblazer, like, he's been there. He's done that. Marvin Vettori is a tough ask on a full camp, let alone 2 weeks.
Exactly. No, I couldn't agree more. And that's the thing that... Here's the thing that is lost when guys come in on short notice. Because this one thing, we see so many people do it that it just kind of becomes a normal part of MMA. But in a 5-round atmosphere, for you to be asked to fight an extra 10 minutes, and I understand Kevin Holland's coming off a 5-round fight, but still, it's not like he was training at his peak for the last 2 weeks. I'm sure he took time off in between. I understand he would be full-time training since when he signed on for this fight, but you're asking him to fight a poor stylistic matchup for him in the first place on only 2 weeks' notice.
One other point about that, just quick. You know, he's kind of teased the welterweight thing. He weighed 183 for the fight against Brunson, so I don't expect the weight to be an issue.
That's a good point.
I don't even really expect the cardio to be a huge issue. I expect Marvin Vettori wearing on you to be the biggest issue. So yeah, we both have Italy's Italian Dream. Marvin Vettori to get the win. Really looking forward to the entire card. 15 fights, 4 interviews, Dawkins, sure. You've got really big ones with Joe Selecki and Sasha Palatnikov. All sorts of great content with Fight Night Picks we brought back this week in MMA. There's early stoppage, and as I said before, question mark kicks on Saturday. We get to offer up our final picks, predictions, and it's a lot of fun over there 2 hours before the prelims. So make sure you tune into all that great stuff. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Fight Night Picks, at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. Like I said, really looking forward to the week that we have ahead in MMA. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it.